Slush, written by Glenn Rolfe, narrated by Joe Hempel. Foreword. I was thrilled when Glenn asked me if I would consider serving as editor for his first collection of short stories and microworks. I've been friends with Glenn for a few years now after I fell in love with his writing during beta reading a few volumes of The Haunted Halls, his serial novel that transformed this summer into his debut novel. I was captivated by Glenn's writing style, his strong voice and use of subtle supernatural and horror elements, which coupled with depth and dimension of his characters, makes for a very compelling read. His novel quickly became one of my most favorite reads, and ever since, I have been eagerly giving early content evaluations on his novellas and works. I'm obsessed with his words, I admit it. Honestly, this New Englander is one of the hardest working people I know. He never wastes a minute, is always pumped and focused, and has stellar vision for where he wants to be in life. He's a great example of how to make it as a fiction writer. And if you didn't know yet, he wants to be a prolific novelist. He's very humble, but let me tell you, he's very good. I haven't felt this feeling I get when reading his short stories since I read most of Stephen King's collections, and they sat percolating in my gut and invading my psyche. Glenn, as well, is a compelling storyteller. All that considered, how could I not be honored to review and edit his works for Slush? Being a writer and editor for well over 20 years myself, Glenn's no-fear attitude, ability to take risks, and overall talent has inspired me even in my own writing. To me, he's proof that when you read great fiction, you become better at your own fiction. And I know he believes this too. It's why he studies the horror masters. I love his short works as much as his novels. It's plural because you don't know about them all yet, but I have a feeling you will soon. And am impressed by how he can create such depth in only a few pages. As soon as he asked, I was ready to dive into the pile, which was good since we had a short deadline. And I didn't care how dark or how dank it was or how chilling. However, what this collection is not is a mound of slush to be shoveled away, or in his case, filed away. It's a great collection of stories that will move you in a myriad of ways if you open your mind and become vulnerable to the art of the written word. In many of the short stories in Slush, coming-of-age teens are the featured characters. Do you remember the hurt and pain and innocence lost of these years? Remember this time of fear of the future or the unknown that haunts existence, many times causing the mind to wander in nightmares and premonitions? As I read these particular stories, I was reminded of how vulnerable we all are in our formative years and how they pretty much make us or break us. Even as the stories are all completely different, they all also deal with fears of these years of impression and chaos. Some of the stories are psychological and painful, echoing years of hurt and frustration, while other stories are stories of revenge. Many of the stories might dig deep into the recesses of the mind, while others showcase how some might deal with anger from being wronged or just simply being fed up. Some are just for shock value or consider the what-ifs of things we can't even begin to explain. Other stories deal with the grief of death, the loss of a parent, the loss of life, and I admit, I connected to them, and they tore my heart out. The emotions overwhelmed me at times and left me feeling spent, but for me, that type of reading invigorates me. I felt alive. I hope they create this rush for you too. All will either make you feel deeply, wipe a tear, vomit, or put your heart in your throat. But trust me, you'll have a reaction. Dealing with anger, loss, and fear are all what makes great horror truly great horror. It isn't always about how much blood is spilled. It's about the atmospheric realities that human emotions and actions make us all struggle to overcome, repress, or subdue, and sometimes what might happen if they are not. These stories will make you feel real, feel alive, feel sick, feel creeped out, feel entertained, but the key word here is feel. And that is what the best writing does. It makes you feel. So crawl up on your couch for All Hallows Eve and read a story or two. Or if you live somewhere that seasons change, treasure the collection through the cold winter months. You might not sleep, but you won't be sorry. Aaron Sweet Al-Meharry, Editor, October 2014. Skull of Snakes. It was the summer of 1989. School vacation was in full effect and we loved every second of it. A quick stop at Boynton's Market for our penny candy and pop rations was always among the first orders of business. Once fully stocked with our daily supply of sugar, we biked back to our little fort in the woods out back of Kirk's house. Fort Eat My Shorts was painted on the poorly constructed sign above the clubhouse door. Its runny red letters were supposed to look like blood. We thought its resemblance to the Camp Blood signs in the Friday the 13th movie series helped to keep the younger kids away. On this particular hot and sticky June morning, we were all fired up for the Hanson Union River Run. It was part of our small town celebration of itself. Hanson Union Weekend featured a parade, a battle of the bands at the Hanson Union Common, a bunch of sidewalk arts and craft things that we paid absolutely no attention to, two nights of fireworks, and of course, the Hanson Union River Run. The River Run consisted of anywhere from 25 to 50 homemade floats that would travel down the Jessup River. It started up in Dutton and wound to its usually dramatic finish at the boat landing here in Hanson Union. It was mostly grown-ups who took part in the race, but this year, Kirk's brother Gary would be participating. He and his football buddies had spent the last 2 weeks building a pirate-themed float. That meant this year, we finally had someone we actually knew and liked to root for. "So can we see it?" Paul was referring to Kirk's brother's float. "Not here, dummy. They took it up to Dutton," Kirk said. "What time does the race start again?" Mike asked. Kirk answered Mike with a little more patience. "It starts at noon, but they won't get down our way until 12:30, 12:45. "Shit! You mean we gotta find stuff to do between now and then?" Paul said as he popped the fireball in his mouth. I had the morning planned out already and decided it was time to let the boys in on it. "We can go back to my house and watch MTV until lunch. My mom's out running errands. I'm sure she'll make us lunch when she gets back too. Then we can head over to the tracks." No one argued. We were back at my house by 9:30. The hours flew by. We watched cool music videos from Guns N' Roses, Skid Row, Poison, and Madonna while playing air guitars and wrestling around until my mom got home. We helped her bring in the groceries and other odds and ends she picked up while she was out, and, just as I knew she would, she made us burgers and fries for lunch. We all thanked my mom before heading out the door and riding our bikes down to the tracks. The tracks were the train tracks out behind Jenner's Grocery. We had watched the river run from this very spot the last 2 years. The location was perfect. The tracks ran across the bank that rose about 25 feet above the river and led straight down to the boat landing. The trees that dressed our side of the river gave way and opened up to a perfect view of the river and its annual parade of canoes and motorboats dressed as floats. The other side of the river, which was tree-free, was where most of the town gathered to watch the race's conclusion, leaving us and a few other kids from our side of the perfect perch our own private spot to witness the grand finale. Paul stared out at the river and said, "Should be coming down any time now, huh, guys?" "Guys?" Kirk and Mike were both standing around me. I'd been walking on the rails, imagining myself as one of those tightrope walkers from the circus, when a shine from the ground caught my eye. I reached down and plucked the shimmering nickel from the rocks between the tracks. It was old, real old. I brushed the dirt off, revealing a buffalo. The most intriguing part of the coin was on its reverse side. I had to scrape the hardened dirt from the coin with my fingernail, but what I found was both amazing and a little creepy. Rather than an old president, this coin featured a skull covered with snakes. There were snakes coming from its gaping mouth, a snake protruding from its left eye, and snakes in place of hair along the entirety of its wide crown. The detail in the carving was brilliant. The guys saw me staring at the coin and wrapped around me to see what I was so lost in.
"Whoa, that's creepy," Mike said. "What the hell kind of coin is that?"
Even Mike's dog breath couldn't distract me from the beauty of the coin.
"I don't know, man, but it's old. Look at that, 1913. This could be worth some real money."
"Hey, guys, what are you looking at?"
Paul said from his post. He was probably catching a hint of the excitement reverberating from our huddle. The lure of our find still wasn't enough to make him abandon his perch.
"It's a buffalo nickel," I said. "Mrs. Oxford talked about them in social studies last year.
At least I thought I'd remembered her talking about them." Kirk backed me up.
Yeah, I remember that.
"Aren't they supposed to have an Indian on them?"
"Yeah, I think that's what she said. But I'm not sure what this is."
I swiped my thumb over the skull and could feel the smooth edge of every detail.
"Guys!"
"Jesus, Paul!"
Kirk barked. "Shut up and get your fat ass over here if you want to see. The floats are coming!"
And there they were. Gary and his football buddies dressed to the gills in pirate regalia, eye patches, ruffled blouses from Kirk's mother's closet, bandanas, and big dangly earrings. The float was cool, too.
The main sail was a bunch of tan and white sheets sewn together and attached to a mast that was just a large PVC pipe. Jutting from both the bow and the stern were two giant black and white flags featuring the Jolly Roger's skull and crossbones design. Kirk, who possessed a hidden talent as an artist, had confessed to me 3 days earlier that he had hand-painted the flags himself at his brother's request. More PVC piping and a bunch of stretched and connected bungee cords served as the ship's handrails, although to me they looked more like ring ropes around a World Wrestling Federation ring. To further enhance the overall ambience of the ship were a couple of papier-mâché cannons and a hope chest that served as their booty. The boys were running in second place behind a lame red, white, and blue American-themed boat. Gary and his buddies had their treasure chest, which turned out to be filled with water balloons, wide open for a last-chance attack.
Whoa! Paul's excitement peaked. They're gonna bombard those old guys with water balloons!
He hopped up and down like a kid in a candy store as he pointed out the obvious. The rest of us fell in behind him and began hooting and hollering for our ship, the creepy old coin, momentarily forgotten. As if on cue, Gary and his pals began grabbing and hurling the multicolored balloons at the lone team they were trailing. The white-haired group of geezers decked out in pink and lavender windbreakers were caught by surprise. The shouts and warrior cries from the high school footballers scared and pissed off the elderly group, who no doubt had been ready to begin celebrating their forthcoming victory. The old guys began to shout back at the pirate misfits, only to have Gary's crew up the ante. Gary and one of the long-haired linebackers, whose name I couldn't recall, pulled out a couple of large super soakers. The old men had no choice but to duck and cover while their captain veered their Lee Greenwood-inspired ship away from the encroaching football pirates. We roared from the sidelines, running along the tracks, following our ship down the river as it passed the last of its competitors and headed toward the finish line. That's when Gary fell into the river. 1 minute he was there laughing, screaming, and throwing balloons. The next, he was gone. I didn't see it happen, but Kirk told us later that he had. The race, along with our collective hearts, ceased as all of the closest competitors closed in and began to search the river's surface for the fallen student. We had to hold Kirk back from running off to the river to help. He shouted for his brother, shouted that he could swim, and that he had to save Gary. We knew the river was way too dangerous, even for a strong swimmer like Kirk. Gary's body was never found. That night, much to our surprise, the town still held the first night of fireworks. In light of our best friend's tragedy, we weren't sure whether we should go. My mom made us. She said that Kirk would need a while with his family, and that the rest of us should try to do something to get our minds off of it. Gary's drowning would be known as it by my mother for the remainder of the summer. We decided to go to the fireworks, but agreed that it wouldn't be any fun. I just want to switch into some jeans, I told the guys as I rushed back into my house. I passed my mother, who was talking in hushed tones, into the phone receiver. I rushed upstairs to my bedroom. The day had been hot and humid, but the night, as if somehow sensing the mood of the day, had cooled. I grabbed the jeans my mother hated with all the homemade incisions. I pulled my shorts off and threw them toward my Nintendo at the foot of my television stand. I heard something ping off the gaming system. I walked over in my underwear and picked up the coin I'd found earlier by the tracks. I had forgotten about it. Gazing into the freaky skull of snakes, I was swept by a mixture of awe and sickness. A strange feeling crept over my emotionally racked nerves and pricked to life the hairs upon the nape of my neck. Lenny! I jumped as my mom bellowed from the bottom of the stairs. Your friends are waiting for you! Freed from the weird trance, I put the coin on top of my TV. I started to pull my jeans on and stopped. There was a burn mark on my upper right thigh. A red circle similar to... I picked up the coin from the TV and held it to the mark. It was a perfect match. What the hell? Lenny! My mom yelled again. What the heck are you doing up there? Your friends don't want to watch the fireworks from our driveway. Hurry up! I threw the coin, along with the $6 I had left in my Superman piggy bank, into the front pocket of my jeans, grabbed my blue hooded sweatshirt, and headed out the door. Nobody said a word as we cruised down Beaumont Hill. We headed toward downtown. I tried to forget about everything that had happened and just enjoy the cool night air blowing against my face and through my hair. Gary and Kirk were on our minds, but my mom was probably right. It wouldn't do any of us any good just sitting around thinking about it. So downtown we rode, the four horsemen minus one. Down on Main Street, there was a mix of blissful ignorance from the younger kids of Hanson Union. They ran and laughed with sparklers in hand, their carefree thoughts wrapped tightly around the fun of the evening. A good number of the older kids and most of the adults that were present wore somber faces. hearts and minds heavy laden with the day's earlier tragedy. We met up with Bryce Cooper and his sister Lana. Bryce helped us break our silence.
What's up, guys? How's Kirk?
Bryce Cooper and his twin sister Lana weren't part of our little tribe per se, but they were the next closest thing. Paul and I both looked to Mike. Mike stared at the ground. He was taking it harder than either of us.
He's at home, obviously with his folks, I said.
Lana put her arm around me and rubbed my back.
I just can't believe it, she said. I feel awful for Kirk. I mean, I didn't really know Gary, but I heard Kirk talk about him so much I almost feel like I did, you know?
Yeah, I said. I hated myself for a moment. My best friend's brother was dead, and here I stood, slightly red in the face, quietly enjoying the fact that Lana Cooper was rubbing my back. I couldn't help but feel like a piece of shit.
Have you guys seen Carrie or Tony?
I asked.
No, I guess some of the parents didn't want their kids coming out tonight and are pretty pissed at the mayor for still having the fireworks. I mean, Christ, they set them off over the river, you know?
Out of the blue, Mike snapped. He threw his bike to the ground and stomped his way over to the side of the street and picked up a pile of bricks from out front of Kent's Hardware and Garden. Before any of us could stop him, he just started screaming and throwing the bricks against the front window of the store. On the third brick, the giant pane of glass smashed and sent shards every which way. Tears streamed down Mike's cheeks. His cries were full of such sorrow. It sounded like his torn soul had been given a voice. My heart hurt listening to him, watching the sad scene play out. Bryce, who was bigger than either Paul or I, and only slightly bigger than Mike, tackled him to the ground as Mr. Kent rushed through the storefront door. There was a sudden pain on my leg, but before I could check it out, Lana screamed. Mr. Kent pulled Bryce off Mike. Mike didn't move. Bryce tried to break free of Mr. Kent's grasp. People filed in and circled around them. I noticed the blood on Bryce's white winger t-shirt and wondered where it had come from. Lana dropped to her knees. Dr. Howard pushed his way past me and knelt beside Mike. Officer Gilbert and Mr. Newman appeared next to him. I couldn't see Mike. Even worse, I couldn't hear him. Paul grabbed my arm.
What's wrong with Mike?
Lenny, what's wrong with Mike?
I tried to concentrate, tried to focus. The world was spinning too fast. I glanced around. Lana was sobbing in the street, rocking back and forth on her knees. Bryce was in tears too. Mr. Kent's eyes were welling up, his face scrunched in a terrible mask of sorrow.
What's wrong with Mike?
Paul's voice sounded on the verge of breaking. I had to see. I had to know. I ran forward, ducking from Mr. Kent's outstretched arm and shoved past a couple of the looky-loos. Officer Gilbert noticed me over his shoulder and turned to shield my view of Mike. He ushered me from the scene, but not before I saw what had happened. Mike's eyes were wide open, but there was nothing behind them. A large sliver of glass protruded from the front of his throat. There was a massive pool of blood spreading out from beneath him. Officer Gilbert ushered me to his patrol car. I could hear Paul, poor lost Paul, yelling to me.
Lenny, what's wrong with Mike? What's wrong with Mike?
I sat in the back of Officer Gilbert's cruiser, cold and numb. I had never known anyone who died. Within 12 hours, I was provided with the first two worst experiences of my life. My dad was waiting for me at the end of the driveway as we pulled up.
Thanks, Danny, he said to Officer Gilbert.
No problem, Craig. For whatever it's worth, I'm sorry. You'll have to excuse me. I've got to get back downtown.
My dad nodded and put an arm around my shoulder. Officer Gilbert climbed back behind the wheel and pulled away. My father looked more broken than I could ever remember. Mike's dad had been Dad's best friend in high school. Mom was probably over at the Leeches right now with Mike's mom, Jenna. Another cruiser sat in their driveway at the end of the block. I went into the house and ran up to my room. My dad didn't even bother to try and come after me. We both had some tears to shed. Duffy's were better at crying alone. I burst through the door and threw myself on my bed. The tears flowed without hesitation, instantly soaking my Superman pillowcase. I'm not sure how long I cried, only that I fell asleep somewhere between the tears and the strange dream I was awoken from by the tapping on my window. Unbelievably, it was Kirk. As I got up and opened the window, I stretched toward the corners of my half-awake mind and grasped for fragments of the odd dream evaporating by the second. In the dream, there had been a house and a young Native American boy who had been mouthing something to me from the porch of the house. Then the sky turned black. Despite my best efforts to retrieve the visions, the dream fell away.
Kirk slipped in through the half-open window. The cool chill of the night followed.
I hope you don't mind me waking you up, man.
Nah, don't worry about it, I said. I'm just surprised to see you. He looked tired. Old even. His steel blue eyes were red-rimmed and bloodshot. His shoulders hunched forward like a fighter that's got nothing left. He was still dressed in his Simpsons t-shirt and black jeans from earlier in the day, and his hair was pulled back in a ponytail. The loose strands wafted like wheat in a lazy summer wind around his face as he stood in front of the box fan I kept running at the foot of my bed. I tried to think of something to say. I tried to find the right words that would take away his pain. The pain that had aged him so much in the course of this one horrible day. This day that had started off as every summer day should. So innocently. So carefree. I searched, but all of my best lines weren't even close. I watched his worn-out eyes stare out the window he'd just climbed through. I took the spot next to him on my bed and threw my arms around him. Our embrace was more than something shared by best friends. It was one of brothers. In that moment, we transcended the bonds of our physical beings, our souls clinging to the remnants of the innocence that had been stolen from us.
I can't believe he's not home right now waiting for me to sneak in and kick my ass and threaten me with Mom, Dad, and...
More tears flowed from Kirk's seemingly endless well. Suddenly, it occurred to me that he may or may not know about Mike. Before I could broach the subject, he wiped the wetness from his cheeks and produced a folded piece of paper from his pocket. What's that? I said.
I needed to do something, you know? I've been crying all friggin' day.
He wiped a fresh tear from his eye.
I remembered that coin you found, the one with the skull and snakes.
I nodded. He continued.
And I remembered last summer when my dad took me to that cryptozoology museum in Danvers.
He held the folded paper in his hands and drifted off, lost in a memory. I waited for him to work through whatever was running around behind his burnt-out eyes.
I remembered that coin you found, and then I remembered the story that grisly old guy at the museum told me.
Kirk unfolded the piece of paper and handed it to me. In big, black, bold print was a headline that read, "The Legend of the Skull of Snakes Coin."
Read it.
Kirk's voice was like background music. I was already devouring the words before me. In 1914, Jeffrey Tuttle and William Hubert robbed men, women, and children up and down the Jessup River. That summer, they also raped and strangled two Native American sisters, taking a satchel of coins from each. In the elder sister's satchel, they found 13 buffalo coins. One stood out over all the others. This one particular nickel had been chiseled, changed from its original form, and transformed into something darker, more menacing. Where the Indian head once had been, now sat a darkly crafted skull. Protruding from the skull were seven serpents. The detail was incredible, and for William, its lure proved irresistible. He tucked the sinister-looking coin in his coat pocket before Jeffrey had a chance to see it. That night, William snuck away from Jeffrey to find a buyer for the impressive coin. On his way, he suffered a severe heart attack and dropped dead in the street. His body was found early the next morning. Jeffrey took the rest of the score and jumped a train headed south. His body was discovered 2 days later in Chettenwood, Tennessee, his tongue swollen within his mouth, his eyes bloodshot and bulging from their sockets. Meanwhile, the Skull of Snakes coin was discovered by Edgar Tomlin, the mortician who took care of William Hubert's body. That afternoon, while peeling potatoes for supper, Tomlin's wife slipped with her sharpest knife and cut her wrist wide open. She bled to death while trying to make the relatively short trek from their home to the town doctor's office. Edgar Tomlin, compelled either by the great loss or the dark force attached to the coin, slit his own wrists 2 nights later. The Skull of Snakes coin was later found by Tomlin's young apprentice, Travis Hicks. Hicks sensed the curse imprinted upon the coin and felt it his obligation to dispose of the coin and whatever evil it possessed. Hicks' body was found floating down the Jessup River the next day. The Skull of Snakes coin was lost to time. I couldn't believe it. I brought my eyes up to meet Kirk's and was completely speechless. My guts sank like a ton of bricks. I felt responsible for Gary's death, for Mike's. Kirk stood.
Where is it? I remembered that Kirk still didn't know about Mike. I have to tell you something. Whatever it is, it can wait. Where's the damn coin?
He began to scan my room from where he stood. I decided not telling him about Mike wouldn't be the worst thing right now. He'd been through enough, and if I could spare him any additional hurt for a few hours, then so be it. I reached into my pocket and came up empty.
Impossible.
Kirk noticed the franticness in my reaction.
What? What is it?
The coin. It was in my... I stopped as I touched the bottom of my pocket lining.
There's a hole in my pocket. It must have slipped out.
What did you do when you got home this afternoon? He put a hand on my shoulder.
Did you go anywhere?
I answered him without thinking.
Yeah, I had it when we went downtown. It might be anywhere between here and Main Street.
A thought struck me. I raised my eyes to meet his.
Or it could be in Officer Gilbert's cruiser.
What? He shook his head, trying to wrap his head around that one.
Wait, why the heck would it be in Officer Gilbert's cruiser? What did you guys do tonight?
Crap. I knew I should tell him what happened, Mike. But there were more pressing matters to tend to. Chances were that the coin was in the back of the cop car. I would have heard it ping off the street had it fallen out of my pocket while we were downtown. Suddenly, I recalled the burning sensation I'd felt on my leg right before Mike lost his shit. I pulled my shorts down.
What the heck are you doing, man?
Kurt brought up his hand to shield his eyes from the unannounced view of my near nakedness. I got the shorts off, pulled the liner up to examine it, and found the hole. The exit aperture was charred. The coin had burned its way through my pants.
It's in Officer Gilbert's car,
I stated without a second thought.
We need to find him. That's where we'll find the coin. How, again, did you end up in the back of a cop car?
Kirk looked a lot like a guy that didn't get a joke.
I'll explain later, but we need to get the coin before something else happens.
I was struck by the thought of what repossessing the coin might mean for us. Would we be better off to just let it go? I thought of Mike. I thought of Gary. I thought of Officer Gilbert. I paused before my bedroom window.
What is it?
Kirk said.
Nothing.
Let's go find the coin and get rid of it. Obviously, we couldn't just walk out my front door. There was my dad and my mom to contend with, and there was Mike's house. Out of the window and through the backyard was the only option. We hit the ground, grabbed our bikes, and got ready to depart. Kirk made the inevitable suggestion.
Let's go get Mike and Paul.
I had to turn my face away from him to hide the tears. I bit my lip, shook my head, and pedaled forward, away from my street.
No time, man. It's just me and you this time. Just me and you.
I was halfway to Cross Street before Kirk could argue. I said a silent prayer that the area in front of Kent's Hardware and Garden where Mike's accident had occurred had been cleaned up and would be devoid of any trace of the night's earlier event. My heart nearly stopped as I saw a chubby kid on a neon green BMX, one just like Paul's, head off west on Emerson Street past Izzy's Flowers. Kirk didn't seem to notice. Kirk's voice came from behind me.
What? What is it? Nothing. Let's hurry up. I don't want to miss Officer Gilbert.
He bought the line, never even bothering to look down Emerson.
I wondered what the hell Paul was doing out here.
He had run away from his mom and stepdad's a couple of times last summer. Maybe with all of the crapola of the day, he was at it again. There were three bright yellow wooden sawhorses and a mess of police line around the ruined storefront. But there were no stragglers, no police, and no body. Kirk's voice broke the replay going on in my head.
What the heck happened to Kent's?
Did you have anything to do with that?
I'll tell you later.
We zoomed past the closed shops lining both sides of the sleeping street. The police station sat quietly at the other end. We reached the station. All of the cop cars were MIA.
He could be anywhere. How are we supposed to track him down?
Kirk's voice sounded tired, ready to quit.
Follow me.
I marched toward the front door of the station.
Where are you going?
He sounded worried.
We can't go in there. They'll... Wait up, man!
I walked through the station's front door and saw Officer Mattingly parked behind the plexiglass window.
Hi, Officer Mattingly.
I tried to sound as calm as possible. Is Officer Gilbert around? Kirk filed in behind me. The look on Officer Mattingly's pudgy face told me that something else awful had happened. There was sadness in his old brown eyes, giving him a look that reminded me of Betty, my grandpa's lab, whenever the rain prevented us from playing out in the yard during these summer days. He tried to mask his obvious distress with mock irritation.
What the hell are you boys doing here?
He tilted his head to look past me and saw Kirk.
This isn't the night for whatever it is you kids are up to. Go home.
We need to find Officer Gilbert, I said. It's an emergency.
He was about to respond when a voice came over the two-way. Dispatch, Officer Pratt to dispatch, over.
Go ahead, Pratt.
Mattingly instantly forgot about us. Pratt's voice came back. This is a mess. We're going to need the jaws of life over here on Herman. It doesn't look good. I backed away.
Will do, Pratt.
Officer Mattingly caught us trying to skulk away.
Hey, Lenny, you kids get back here. Hey!
We ran through the doors and jumped on our bikes.
Where are we going, Lenny?
Kirk asked.
I could tell his adrenaline was kicking in. There was a hint of excitement in his voice.
Herman Street, I yelled back over my shoulder. I think something bad happened to Officer Gilbert.
I didn't want to be right. I wanted this to all be part of some messed up crazy dream. I wanted everything to go back to the way it had all been this morning.
As we crested Beaumont, we saw two other police cruisers, two fire trucks, and an ambulance. At the foot of Beaumont, where it T-boned with Herman, was a smoldering upside-down cop car. Just off to the right of the cop car was a mangled, neon-green bike frame.
Holy shit! Lenny, look, is that...
In the middle of the road was a lump under an off-white canvas covering. I had no doubt that there was a body under there, and it was either Officer Gilbert or the owner of the mangled bike frame. Without knowing, I knew. I knew it was Paul. Let's go home, I said. The flat words barely made it past my lips.
That thing in the road, that bike frame, don't you think it kind of looks like Paul's? I mean, I can't be sure. I mean, it can't be his, right? That's somebody else's.
Kirk sat there thunderstruck, waiting for me to respond. When I didn't, he asked,
what about the coin?
Trust me, Kirk. We're safer if we forget about it.
I began to pedal for home. I looked over my shoulder and saw Kirk staring at the accident. Tears were sliding down his cheeks as he zoned into the destructive scene below. I was getting ready to turn back when Kirk said,
whoa, Lenny, Lenny!
I spun my bike around and pedaled to his side.
What the hell?
A flame had sparked to life within the turned-over cruiser. Two police officers jumped back from the growing blaze, and the officer closest to the vehicle began to twist and thrash. The back of his uniform was on fire. I could hear his screams from the top of the hill.
The coin. The damn coin is doing this.
The two firefighters charged forward to help, but the burning patrolman, arms flailing and his entire back now engulfed in flame, threw himself over the guardrail and disappeared from sight. Within seconds, another flicker of light started to grow from where he'd vanished.
Jim! Jim!
The officer cried.
Get back! Get back! The car's gonna blow!
One of the firefighters yelled. I glanced over at Kirk. His jaw hung to his chest. His eyes were reflecting the fire's brilliance. A thunderous boom from below caused me to flinch. Instinctively, I held my arms up to protect my face.
Oh my God!
Kirk said. The cruiser's explosion seemed too big to be real. The two firefighters had their hose on and were already at the burning remains when the woods beyond the guardrail suddenly bloomed to life in an even larger orange and gold blaze.
The body,
Kirk pointed. The covered body in the road was burning too. Another body writhed aflame 20 feet to the right.
The other officer, the one who'd cried out to Jim.
Sirens filled the night. The wails rang out. The voice to the horrors before us.
Come on, Kirk. We should get out of here. No, look. There, that shine in the road. Do you see it?
I didn't want to look upon the awful scene anymore. I just wanted to get home.
Is that?
He was off before I could stop him.
Kirk, come back.
I had no choice. I had to follow. I couldn't let him go alone. I raced down the hill after him. The sirens grew louder, closer. The conflagration in the woods ahead lit up the night sky like it was lunchtime.
This was a horrible idea. There was nothing but death here.
And the coin. Kirk dismounted his bike and dumped it to the curb at the bottom of the hill. He rushed to the street. I finally saw what he was going for. There in the road was the glimmer of the coin. He picked it up and hurried back. I rode over to him and reached out my hand.
Give it to me.
No, let's go.
Kirk, I mean it. Give it to me. This is all my damn fault. I never should have picked it up in the first place. Gary, Mike, Paul.
Mike? Kirk looked ahead toward the burnt thing in the road.
Paul? I was going to tell you, man, but this is all... I don't even know.
Kirk held out the coin and glared at the skull of snakes. He clenched it in his fist, got on his bike, and took off down Herman Street.
Wait! Wait for me!
I had trouble keeping up with him. He turned down Millwood Road, then on to Guilford Street. He was going to the river. I had my head on a swivel, certain that a car or truck would appear from out of nowhere to clip one or both of us. None did. We made it to the Gunther Johnston Memorial Bridge. I pulled up next to Kurt at the center of the bridge. He sniffled and wiped at his eyes with the sleeve of his sweatshirt. He was out of breath, and so was I.
Is Mike?
Is Mike dead?
Yeah.
And that body? That bike in the road?
Paul.
Christ, Lenny.
He held the coin in front of his stomach and glanced down at his open palm. Teardrops landed softly around the evil in his hand.
What the Christ is this thing?
A curse. Nothing but a goddamn curse. I walked over, tears filling my eyes, and wrapped one arm around him. I reached down and took the curse from him. I looked him in the eyes and never felt such grief, such loss, such heartache in my life. I clenched my jaw, gripped the coin tight, and took a step back. I thought of Gary going over the edge of the pirate float. I thought of Mike's rage and saw the glass poking through his neck. I thought of Paul and the blaze from Herman Street. I clenched the Skull of Snakes coin in my hand and dared it to heat up. Dared it to do its dirty trick. Dared it to take its shot at me. It remained a cold, dead chunk of silver. Who knows? Maybe we'd drained it. Maybe it was tapped. Maybe it satisfied its lust for death for another 100 years. I lunged forward, placed my free hand on the railing of the bridge, and hurled the curse back to the Black River. I hoped that the damn thing would sink so low that no one would ever find it. According to the legend, though, someday, somehow, the coin would be back for more blood. For now, I was just happy to be rid of it. When I got home, my dad was passed out, head down at the kitchen table, with an empty bottle of whiskey next to his hand. If I were a little older myself, I'd have been sitting right there next to him. As I started up the stairs toward my room, I caught a glimpse of my mom curled up on the living room sofa. This day had sucked the innocence from all of us. I just wanted to sleep, and I didn't care if I didn't wake up for months. I didn't want to feel like this tomorrow, but I knew I would. Lying on my bed, I looked down at the burnt circle on my thigh. The coin hadn't killed me, but it did leave a mark. The day of June 24th would stay with me, my family, and my small, even smaller, group of friends for the rest of our lives.
Sweet 16. I knew the first time our eyes met, you were mine. An unspoken offer to fill one another's romantic void secretly passed between us. I just turned 18. You were about to hit your sweet mark. And that's exactly what you permeated. Sweetness. Blooming spring flowers, rhubarb pie on Saturday afternoon, and a mother's goodnight kiss. Your demise, quite the contrary. But I swear I'll hold you until your smell gives us away. I remember our first official date, The Amazing Spider-Man. You kind of looked like the girl that plays Gwen Stacy, and I could have been the new Peter Parker's twin. My palms grew sweaty as our cinematic doppelgangers kissed on the big screen. A glance in your direction told me we made another one of those quiet agreements. Our kiss was coming, and that night it did. I walked you home from the Julian Theater. The sticky, sweet July night brought perspiration to your cherry-glossed lips. I yearned for them like I'd never yearned for anything before. We took it slow, as two teenagers in mad love could, which is to say that we visited, and revisited, all the bases a number of times before you waved me home. We piled up the hits, the extra bases, and 2 days after our one-month anniversary, while your mom and dad were at work, we laid our innocence to rest. My head went to an infinite space somewhere high above the clouds. Dreams were not capable of matching the perfection of that moment. My smile was miles and miles across the universe. You cried. We were different after. I gained an edge reminiscent of Arnie Cunningham in that Stephen King movie. You looked wounded, like an angel with corroded wings. Something new emerged on the faces of those I'd grown up with. Fear. The glances from kids like Jack Nichols and his butt buddy Kurt Heath morphed from "What a loser," to, "Please don't look at me. I don't want any trouble." I got so wrapped up in this fantastic development that I lost sight of the beauty that created it. Your friend, Gina, spewed vomit from her eyes at me. But I knew she was afraid too. And so were you. No matter how many times I kissed your soft lips or made love to you with everything that I had, your eyes were a sadness that I couldn't bleed out. I lost something too, and replaced it with rage. You looked at your sneakers when I said good morning at school. I marked my forearm in the boys' room with my switchblade. You sat tight-lipped, your body stiff as a board when I put my arm around you at the Friday night football games. I used the knife against my flesh under the bleachers where we should have been naked and going at it. You whispered my name to Gina and then held your breath like you were underwater once I appeared from around the corner. Later, staring at my scarred and bloody arm,
Undressed in the center of my bedroom, I made a pledge to make you think of me as beautiful again. 2 weeks before Halloween, darkness festered in my mind. You left a message on my phone. I think we need to talk. I'd been thinking the same thing. You came over at 4 o'clock. The sun was already falling from the sky, the earth ready to swallow the light whole. I waited for you, and then asked you to walk around the back of the house with me. You resisted, claiming you just wanted to say what you came to say and then be on your way. Lucky for me, my mother came out to have her pre-dinner cigarette. For the sake of privacy, you agreed to go out back. I think we should break, was all you could say before I placed a hand on the top of your purple knit cap, and the blade broke your skin just beneath your trembling chin. Blood gushed like I'd yet to see from my own wounds, but you were silent. I held you tight, like the first night we kissed, as I laid you down behind the old gray picnic table. With your life, like the sun at our backs, slipping from this world, I stepped over to the table, kicked it aside, exposing the 4-foot grave I made the night before. 6 feet deep was the norm, but yours was much shallower. I didn't want to have to do all that digging every time I needed to see you. I picked you up, feeling the warmth of your body one last time, and placed you in the hole. I pulled my switchblade from your pristine, expressionless face and leaned in to kiss the lips of sweet, lovely death. I dug you up and slept next to you all that week. Part of me was still angry with you. The other part forgave you every night. My mother didn't seem to notice my cologne was less Drakkar Noir and more rotting corpse. At school, the accusations were the whispers in the halls, the hurt in the eyes of your friends, and the empty seat next to me at lunch. I continued to love you, and they remained jealous. I told your mother repeatedly over the phone that you are my angel, my sweet 16. She cried. I smiled, hung up, and went to lay with you for a little while. 2 weeks into our new life, the police searched the property and found you. I'm locked up at Thomaston Prison now. I've been sodomized and torn 3 times since they introduced me to this population of monsters. It hurts, but I just think of us. At night, I block out the catcalls by closing my eyes and imagining removing the dirt from your new resting place, wherever they placed you, opening whatever fancy box they stuck you in, and squeezing in beside you. Jackie boy.
Jackie! Jackie boy! His mother yelled. Be right there, Ma, he said.
Jackie Anderson finished squeezing the intestines from the rat he had caught mucking around with Nola, Mama's prize mare. Nola snorted as Jackie flung the lifeless, and now gutless, rat out of the little makeshift stable's backside window.
That old rat won't be bothering you no more, Nola, he said to the horse.
He closed up his plastic baggie of rat innards, carefully tucking them in the front pocket of his sweatshirt, and made his way to the house. He ran up the porch steps, holding the front pouch of his sweatshirt, and made his way through the screen door.
Jackie boy, his older brother Jared said. What you been doing out there all this time?
Jared leaned over his steaming plate of ham and potatoes.
It's dark already. You been gone out there since after lunch.
I was just taking care of Nola, he said. He grabbed a plate from the edge of the table and plopped on a scoop of potatoes fit for a king.
You ain't been humping that horse, have you?
Jared said, laughing at his own joke. He was the only one who ever did.
Jared Elijah Anderson! You quit that kind of talk at my dinner table. I don't want to hear another disgusting thing from your mouth, or you can go straight up to your room and stay there,
his mother said. His brother shut up. Jackie grabbed a couple thick slices of ham and sat down next to his mother. Dinner was fantastic. Dessert would be better. Jackie finished his food, cleared his plate, and placed it on the counter next to the sink.
I'm going to do some reading before bed, he said.
He stepped up next to his mother, who was now at the sink preparing to clean the dinner plates, and gave her a kiss on the cheek. He stood eye to eye with her.
My Jackie boy, when did you get so big? She said. Why, I remember when you were hardly up to my shoulders. Oh, how the time does fly. It's from eating all your good cooking, he said.
His mother smiled.
Good night, Mama. Good night, Jackie boy.
Jackie climbed the stairs, each one squawking out from old age. He reached the top step and darted into his bedroom 2 doors down the hall. He shut the door behind him and flicked on the little lamp atop his bureau. Slinking over to the desk under his bedroom window, Jackie Boy reached into the pouch of his sweatshirt and eased out the plastic baggie of rat intestines. He clicked on the desk lamp, sat in the chair, and held the clear baggie up before the light. He tilted it back and forth and watched the blood run from one corner to the other. He liked the blood almost as much as the squishy guts. Since he'd started the odd little rat gut ritual, he had moved away from pie and ice cream as after-dinner treats and gone on to a more satisfying dessert. Plus, he was helping keep the little pests from Nola. He opened the little bag, held it up to his mouth, and drizzled the blood and fluids onto his tongue. He relished every precious drop. The innards were the real delicacy. He reached in with his fingers and scooped the soft little clumps from the bag and shoveled them into his mouth. The squirt of fluids popping and shooting the walls inside his cheeks brought him such bliss. He chewed and smiled, enjoying every slippery, slimy chunk before swallowing. Finished, he tossed the baggie into the back of his closet with the rest. The smell was getting pretty bad in there. He was surprised his mom hadn't smelled it yet. He made a mental note to clean it out in the morning. He stripped down to his underwear, grabbed a Playboy out from under his mattress, slipped under the covers, and tugged himself to sleep. In the morning, he woke up with his hand still clamped to his thing. His girly magazine had fallen to the floor. He got up, returned the magazine to its special place beneath his mattress, and pulled on his cargo shorts from the day before. He climbed into a clean white t-shirt and ducked out of his bedroom. He forgot all about the smell from the closet and bounced downstairs where the pop and sizzle of bacon were playing his favorite morning melodies. His mother stood at the stove where pans of bacon, scrambled eggs, and home fries were being whipped to perfection. His mother was a regular magician at the stove. He marveled at her skill.
"Morning, Jackie boy," she said.
"Morning, Ma."
He grabbed a plate from the clean pile next to the sink, joined her by the mixture of intoxicating breakfast aromas, and gave her a quick peck on the cheek as she filled his plate with some of her morning magic. He sat down and dug in.
"Your brother could have used your help this morning."
"Oh, yeah? What for?"
he said between bites. "He had to jumpstart that dang car of his again. Had a hell of a time, too."
"Serves him right for buying that junk box from Mr. Carson," he said.
Mr. Carson sold more garbage to idiots like his brother on a daily basis than any flea market could ever wish to.
"You better enjoy that. I'm heading to Mrs. Nicholas's house today for lunch. You'll have to fend for yourself. There's leftover ham in the fridge."
He threw his last piece of greasy bacon into his mouth, dropped his plate off at the sink, and headed out the door. He was at the bottom of the steps when his mother yelled out,
"Jackie boy, you see my plastic baggies? I swear I bought a new box last week," she said. "I don't know, Ma. I ain't seen them."
He'd stolen the near-full box 4 days ago.
"Come on, you little rat bastards. Jackie boy's gonna need a snack before lunch."
The thought brought a smile to his face. It didn't take him long to catch one. In the first 5 minutes in the old barn, he heard the skittering feet running overhead in the small loft. Nola snorted and danced back and forth. He moved to her side, petting her, whispering,
"Shh, it's okay, Nola. Jackie boy will take care of that little bugger."
The heat of the early June morning was already settling in for the day. He grabbed a cold can of Coca-Cola from the beat-up but functional mini-fridge Jared had bought from Mr. Carson last summer, popped the top, and guzzled half of it down. He finished the drink and threw the can in with the others in the milk crate by the door.
"Time for some exterminating," he declared.
He grabbed the rat catcher, an old pillowcase fastened to a broomless broomstick, from the corner of the room and climbed the ladder to the loft. Beads of sweat popped on his forehead and down his spine. He wished he'd grabbed a second Coke. He sat silent, perched and ready. 20 seconds later, the rat scurried into sight. He dropped the pillowcase net down over top of the rodent, twisted the handle, and captured his first one of the day.
"Told you I'd get him, Nola,"
he said from his perch above. Nola snorted as if she understood.
"You're welcome, Nola."
He tied off the top of the pillowcase with a piece of rope from his pocket. He sat the rat catcher down and moved to the corner where he kept his tools. Inside of a hollowed-out teddy bear he'd received from Grandma Cassie, he pulled out the small box of baggies his mother had been looking for, along with the tiny box of razor blades he'd purchased from Hussey's Hardware. He ducked under the old pulley system they used to haul up hay and kneeled before his father's old toolbox. He lifted the rusted metal lid. There were only two tools inside, a ball-peen hammer and an old rusty Phillips head screwdriver. Jared had claimed the rest of the tools for himself. He grabbed the hammer. He returned to the open area of the loft and spread out the old blanket they kept for nights it got too cold for Nola. Gathering his tools and the rat catcher, Jackie Boy prepared for his new favorite ritual. First, he needed to kill the rodent. He picked up the hammer, held it over the squirming pillowcase, and watched as the rat tried in vain to find his way out.
"Okay, you little bastard," he said.
He reached down with his free hand to grab the moving creature. He grabbed hold and was met with loud shrieks from the critter within. He located the bobbing head and brought the hammer up. Jackie Boy brought the hammer down with a sense of power and something that oddly bordered on ecstasy. The rat twitched until it stopped.
There, that wasn't so bad.
He picked the broom handle up and untwisted the makeshift net. Picking up the edge of the pillowcase, he flipped it over and dumped the dead rat onto the blanket.
Oh, ain't you a fatty?
He salivated at the thought of the plump innards with which this particular rat was sure to be packed. He snatched up a baggie, grabbing an extra just in case he needed it. Then, he opened the box of razors, pulled out a fresh and shiny one, and placed it between his lips. He hid the mushed head behind the palm he held to the rat's throat and stretched out the belly of the beast with his other hand. He took the moment to stroke the stomach. It was still warm. He pulled the razor from his mouth and pushed the tip in just below the rodent's throat. Blood trickled out next to his hand. He pulled the razor down the length of the dead thing and moaned just as he had last night under his sheets. The underside of the rat split, promising Jackie Boy his reward. He dropped the razor and snatched up the sandwich baggie and placed it to the freshly made incision. He picked the body of the rat up and squeezed the blood and soft innards into the pouch.
Hey, jerk off!
It was Jared.
What's he doing here? And how come I didn't hear his crappy car coming up the driveway?
Jackie's hands trembled as he tried to figure out what to do. He couldn't let Jared see what he was doing.
He'd freak out and tell their mother.
And Jackie would die before his mother learned that her sweet, sprouting prince was a twisted son of a gun.
Jackie, that's you? What the hell you doing up there?
Jared said.
Nothing?
Jackie Boy fumbled the box of baggies and the box of razors into the hollowed bear. He heard Jared climbing the ladder behind him.
Oh, shit! What the hell?
Jared said. Jackie managed to hide his tools and fold the blanket, but as he lifted them up to carry back to their storage spots, the little baggie of gooey blood and guts fell to the floor. It landed with a slap. The precious juices splattered upwards. Jackie turned in time to watch the fluid splash his brother across the face.
Ew! What the hell is this?
Jared reached up and touched his cheek. Jackie watched his brother's eyes go from the blood on his fingertips to the still oozing rat carcass just beyond Jackie's feet.
You sick little freak! What are you doing with that?
Jared stopped mid-sentence. Jackie dropped the blanket and bear, but held on to the ball-peen hammer.
Oh, that's it. That is it. I'm telling Ma what a sick...
The wet thud produced from the hammer smashing into his brother's skull was the next-to-last sound Jared Anderson ever produced. The last was when his body smacked the barn floor. Nola neighed.
Shh, Nola. I had to do it.
She neighed again. Jackie Boy climbed down the ladder and went to her.
Shh, it's okay, Nola. It's okay. I'll take care of this. Jackie Boy will take care of this.
He turned from the horse and stared at the dead form of his brother. A delicious new idea crossed his mind. It took a bit of time and ingenuity, but he managed to use the old pulley to get his brother's body up to the loft. He was sweating like that fat kid, Kyle, in his gym class. The muscles in his arms, back, and pectorals burned, but he was young. The soreness wouldn't last. He spread Nola's blanket back out on the ground and grabbed the teddy bear. He dragged his brother over to the blanket and reached into the bear for the box of razors. Surely his brother's guts would be too big for the baggies. He used a fresh blade to cut the front of Jared's smiley face t-shirt open, exposing his brother's tight stomach. Jared had always stayed in good shape. With only the slightest of hesitations, Jackie placed the tip of the razor to the top of his brother's abdomen. This was going to get messy. It had taken him a good 45 minutes of cutting and digging with the razor blade to get Jared's innards. He had to abandon the tiny blade shortly after the initial incision. He used the old Phillips head screwdriver to rip open his brother's flesh down to the bottom of his stomach. He had snacked on organs. He wasn't sure exactly which ones. He had taken biology this year as a freshman, but spent more time staring at Gina Collins than Mr. Kane. When he was finished devouring the first of Jared's parts, it became clear that he would need to save as much of these tasty treats as he could. One baggie would simply not do. Luckily, he had an entire box of them. By the time his mother returned from Mrs. Nicholas's, nearly 3 hours later, Jackie had managed to bury Jared's carcass out by the old oak tree right beside Jared's old dog, Buck. The mini-fridge in the barn now contained a number of squishy treats in little sandwich bags. By supper, his mother began to wonder what was keeping Jared.
I bet that car of his crapped out on him again in town somewhere. I'm sure he'll be back,
Jackie said. He stuffed his face with the scrumptious chicken breast his mother had cooked.
You're probably right, Jackie boy. I told him that car wasn't worth a damn, she said.
Jackie finished his meal, cleared his plate, and tucked it in the sink.
I'm heading up to bed. I've got some more reading to do tonight, he said.
He gave her a kiss goodnight and moved towards the stairs.
All that reading you're doing, why, you might just grow up to be a doctor, his mother said.
He smiled at the thought. He already discovered a love for cutting into flesh.
Yeah, maybe, Ma. Dr. Jackie Boy Anderson. That would sound pretty good, huh?
Sure would, she said from the sink.
Good night, Jackie Boy.
As he headed to his room, he pulled the baggie of tonight's squishy delicacies from the big pockets of his cargo shorts. He'd found something much more satisfying than rat guts.
The curse.
Can you believe she did that to us?
Cindy's agitation permeated the small locker room like the scent of a dirty teenage secret. Jillian stuffed her plaid skirt, her socks, and her shin guards into her gym bag on the floor. She thought about the way Coach Haggis had let the rest of the team go home early and made her and Cindy stick around for extra drills. Today's extra drills consisted of the coach whacking them in the shins to toughen them up. Even with the shin guards on, it hurt like hell. Jillian rubbed her bruised legs and watched Cindy do the same. It was total bullshit. Jillian stood and looked around before she replied.
She's a crabby old bitch. I heard she's been like this forever.
Her discontent built like a rocket set to explode.
She treats us like rescued orphans that owe her grand holiness our blood, sweat, and tears. Well, fuck that.
Ms. Love?
Jillian faltered in Coach Haggis's sudden presence.
Is there something you'd like to say to me?
Hmm?
Cindy dropped her gaze to the floor, buttoned her jeans, gathered up her equipment, and flashed a quick cringe at Jillian. The smell of lavender mixed with sweat and booze seemed to reach out and wrap itself around Jillian like a malevolent apparition. She stood half-dressed in a bra and panties with nothing but hope that the broad shadow engulfing her own would let her loose-lipped comments slide.
Ms. Busey, why don't you head home, hmm? Miss Love and I have a few...
Coach Haggis turned her glare to Jillian.
Things to discuss.
Jillian's stomach swam with writhing snakes. There was no doubt the mad woman had something terribly cruel in mind for her. As she watched Cindy collect her things and scurry away, Jillian felt no sense of abandonment from her friend, as her reaction would have been identical were the situation reversed. Cindy rounded the corner of the orange and black team-colored lockers. The silence in the rumor mill was complete. Jillian could hear the hammering of her own nervous heart. Coach Haggis stepped before her in a gray sweatsuit and grass-stained tennis shoes. The reflective silver whistle of the damned, as the girls so lovingly referred to it, hung just above Jillian at eye level. Flashes of legendary abuse involving this menacing beast of a woman and her past players raged like a river of vile consequences somewhere between Jillian's ears. She decided a preemptive strike in the form of an apology would give her the best chance of getting out of this nightmare unscathed.
Ms. Hag, it's Coach Haggis, you conniving little cunt!
Jillian's stomach tensed. Her resolve, or what was left of it, withered. Coach Haggis's profanity was nothing new. The old woman was often an offensive bitch outside of earshot of the rest of the faculty. And since moving practice from the new high school to the otherwise abandoned old one, her foulness had escalated exponentially. It wasn't the coarse language, but the storm that usually followed Coach's foul-mouthed outbursts that stirred Jillian's anxiety like a cocktail of maggots and hairy spiders. Coach Haggis's harsh words were accompanied by spittle and aged venom that could burn your eyes from your head. Jillian brought up a trembling hand to wipe the saliva from her cheek. The large woman raised her chubby right hand above her head and delivered a powerful strike that caught Jillian completely off guard. Jillian crumpled like a rag doll and landed awkwardly on the bench behind her. A brand new dread flooded her marrow. Stars and red dots filled her vision, floating before the blurred figure standing above her. She could feel her left eye beginning to swell. She'd heard the rumors of what Coach was capable of, but now she'd experienced firsthand the unbound ferocity. Coach Haggis squatted behind the bench and leaned into the girl's bruised face. Behind breath that reeked of shit, through grinded flat yellow teeth, she issued her parting jibe.
Now, a girl like you has got to learn a little respect. You damn sluts think you're God's gift to the world.
Coach Haggis trailed off. She brought the offending hand up to the darkening puffiness around the edge of the girl's eye. Caressing the left side of Jillian's face, she wiped a tear away with her thumb before halting the calloused nub directly above the fresh bruise.
Now here's how it's going to go. You're going to tell your skank mother and your loser father that you caught a high stick in the face at practice. Hmm?
Jillian couldn't speak.
I said this happened at practice, right?
She applied a slight pressure to the contusion. Jillian winced at the pain, shedding a fresh batch of tears as she nodded her head emphatically. Coach Haggis let go of the young girl's face and stood back up.
If I hear anything about this little correctional moment, even being whispered on the wind, I promise you, Our next meeting will be more private and much more personal.
Hmm?
Jillian wiped the tears from her stinging eyes and nodded in acknowledgement. Good girl. Now cover yourself up and get the hell out of my locker room. The old woman waddled off and disappeared among the rows of metal lockers. Jillian sat up and placed a hand to her sure-to-be blackened eye. She was upset with herself for letting the old woman break her so easily. She could have sat up, taking the unexpected punch, and showed more pride in herself, but she'd been too chicken shit. Jillian reached for the sea-green handle of her gym bag, pulled out some jeans and a navy blue t-shirt, and got dressed. She placed her field hockey equipment back in her locker and slung the hefty gym bag over her shoulder. She wondered if Cindy would be waiting outside. She had to pass by Coach Haggis's office on her way out of the locker room. Jillian dared a peek in the window and saw Coach Haggis, cigarette in mouth, thermos in hand, staring at a tiny television that faced away from the door. Jillian tucked her chin to her chest, eyes at her feet, and headed toward her freedom with a black eye, hurt pride, and all. She could hear the rain pound against the old high school building before she burst through the double doors at the end of the cold hall. The downpour sounded angry, like a thousand pissed-off hornets. The gray sky matched Jillian's misery. Cindy was waiting across Wimbling Street in the beat-up Suzuki Swift her parents got her the day she got her driver's license. Jillian ran to the little red vehicle and opened the passenger door.
"Shit, Jay, are you all right?"
"I'll live," she said.
She tossed her bag in the back seat next to Cindy's and dropped herself into the car. Tears welled up, but this time she refused to let them go. Cindy got in and started the engine. Courtney Love's unmistakable snarl blared to life. "Go on, take everything I want you to." Cindy threw the little car in drive and drove up the hill and out of sight of Coach Haggis's field hockey hell house. Cindy grabbed a pack of Winston lights from under her seat, offered one to Jillian, and then bit one from the pack for herself. Jillian lit both of their cigarettes. She cracked her window. Cindy did the same. Cold rain spit through the slim space. Jillian's long hair whisked around the right side of her face as the wind tried to find its way in. She tucked the loose strands back behind her ear and shivered. The September nights had already gone frigid, but this was the first hint of fall gripping its claws in deep.
"Are you going to tell anybody?" Cindy asked, blowing smoke toward the window. "Like who? My mom? She thinks the world of Coach Haggis."
Jillian took a long drag of her own. Her resentment toward her mother only made things worse.
"I don't understand why. Maybe she was nicer to your mom's team. You know, because they were the first team after the accident."
Cindy turned on the windshield wipers to combat the heavy rain.
"You'd think so, but my dad always gets pissed when she defends Coach. It's like he knows something, but my mom gives him an eye slap, and he goes back to his beer and his mash reruns and doesn't say another word about it."
Jillian took another drag as she began to space out, becoming mesmerized by the steady downpour outside. The Suzuki's wipers thrashed to keep up, and Jillian could identify with their struggle. With the way her mother had pushed her into playing for Coach Haggis, refusing to hear anything remotely unflattering about the woman, and then refusing to let her quit the team like she wanted to, it wasn't an easy situation to navigate, and now she'd taken a direct attack, provoked or otherwise, from that cranky old hag. What would her mom think about that? She wouldn't find out, though. Coach Haggis made sure to squash that avenue before it even had a chance to present itself.
"Did your mom and dad date in high school?" Cindy said.
Jillian shrugged her shoulders as she gazed out at the wet battle before her.
"I don't know. They never talk about things like that, and I've never bothered to ask."
She knew they'd gone to the same school that they'd known each other from, but when they actually got together, she couldn't say for sure. She had never been one of those romantic girls, not even in the sixth grade when boys stopped being gross and started to make her blush. Most of her friends, present company included, started daydreaming about weddings and young knights in ripped-up jeans and Nikes. Jillian refused to get swept away in the trappings of love and chose to keep her feelings private. She did all her talking in her journal. The social world of a teenager was far too unstable to divulge any kind of info that could easily lead to the most mortifying situations at any moment. It wasn't like her mother was the most approachable person on the planet either. Coach Haggis's skank comment hadn't been the first insinuation attached to her mother. There were plenty of reasons for her dad to spend his evening in the bottle. Her mom's social activities were among them. "We can't let her get away with doing that to you." Cindy poked the cigarette butt out the window and rolled the window the rest of the way up. "You know she put that cigarette burn on Haley's arm."
"I thought Haley said it was a dare with Megan, something about trying to impress Greg Jennings."
"They've done plenty of stupid things this year to amaze Greg and his burnout brother Jackson, but not that.
I'm guessing Coach gave you a story to share, too. You caught a high stick in the face at practice, hmm?
Jillian looked out her window, bit her lip, and swallowed the shame that rose like bile.
How does she get away with it? She's been like this since she started coaching in the late 60s. She knows how to keep us quiet. We're not the first, but it's just she's gotten worse since moving us back to the old field. There's no one to stop her.
Jillian raised a hand to her sore face. She thought of the ugly mark on Haley's forearm. She recalled a rumor she'd heard back in junior high about the nasty high school field hockey coach pulling players by the hair. She thought it was all big talk by players who hated tough coaches. Now she had a much clearer picture. Anger spilled like black ink over her naivety.
What do we do? Trap her in her office and set it on fire?
Jillian said.
No. What are you, psycho or something? No, nothing that extreme. Jeez. You watch too much Nightmare on Elm Street. Well, what then? I'm thinking something a little less Freddy Krueger and more The Craft.
Cindy pulled up to a small one-story white house with green shutters and parked in the empty driveway. She killed the engine, turned, and locked eyes with Jillian.
I've heard a rumor about her championship team that died.
Jillian perked up.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
You have to promise not to laugh.
Yeah, fine, whatever. No, I mean it. This sounds pretty crazy, but I believe it. Okay, yeah, I won't laugh, even if you tell me Coach died in that bus too and that we've been pushed by a ghost all year.
Cindy didn't laugh. She looked away, put her hands in the air, and said,
You know what, Jay? I guess you don't want to hear this. I thought you would, especially after getting beat up by the old bitch, but you'd rather be a wise guy and let it go.
Jillian grabbed Cindy's arm and pulled her friend back to face her.
Okay, I'm being a shithead. I'm sorry. I promise I won't laugh. Now what is it?
Cindy gazed at her in silence a moment.
All right. So you know the state champs from 70 didn't repeat in 71 because they lost their regional match down in York, right?
She continued.
Well, they got on the bus late that night after the match. Rumor has it they got royally bitched out, and probably far worse, by Coach afterwards. Coach refused to join the team for the ride home and took a separate bus back. Linda Clooney's aunt Sandy was a member of the staff that went along. She ended up staying down in New Hampshire with some family. So Linda's aunt hates Coach Haggis and quit when she got home. She says that Coach was harder on the state champs and a lot meaner too. 20 years ago, teachers and coaches got away with a lot more.
Jillian sat quiet, eyes wide with anticipation.
Linda says her aunt told her that Coach used to slap her star players, cuss them out, and even spit in their faces. Her aunt Sandy couldn't do anything about it. Her best friend's daughter was the starting forward, Bethany Hilton, and Bethany made Sandy promise not to tell. She didn't want anything to jeopardize their undefeated season. So Sandy promised and became a shoulder the girls could lean on throughout the rest of the year. Did she rat out Coach after she got back from North Carolina?
Jillian said.
No, with the whole town in mourning after the accident, she figured it wasn't the right time and eventually decided it wasn't worth the trouble. Bethany and the rest of the girls were gone, and she had quit, so she washed her hands of the whole situation and never had a reason to check up on things again until last year when Linda joined the team.
Cindy started the car and backed out of the driveway.
What are we doing?
Jillian asked. Cindy stopped in the empty road, pulled out a couple more cigarettes, lit both, and handed one to Jillian.
You'll see.
The little red car pulled to the Heaven's Gate Cemetery entrance of Gale Street. Coach Haggis watched from her station wagon, half in the bag, and wondered what that little tramp Cindy Busey was up to.
Why are we back here? Jillian asked.
She stared at the wrought iron fence and the large rock that sat by the entrance. Carved into the stone in childish script was Heaven's Gate.
This graveyard is the home to some special people.
Cindy stepped out of the car. The rain had let up, but left the air with the stink of mildew and mud, the way it always did in Hollis Oaks after a fall downpour. Jillian followed Cindy through the open gate and down the right-hand path. She glanced at the names and death dates engraved on the collection of old stones. She recognized plenty of last names, names of friends and town people that she knew.
What are we looking for?
Cindy said nothing. She continued into the heart of the cemetery. Jillian looked over her right shoulder at the school and the field they had just practiced on. And all the time they had practiced here, the graveyard never really crossed her mind. Seeing the field from amongst the graves gave her an eerie new perspective. She didn't like it.
Over here, Cindy called.
Jillian had fallen behind, staring in a chilling trance out at the field. She snapped to attention and jogged over to Cindy.
Recognize any names?
Cindy gestured at the markers around them.
Well, yeah, we know most of these families. Jillian's voice trailed off as she looked from one stone to the next. This is where they're buried. All of them. Cindy pointed down at one of the headstones. Every girl from the 71 squad was there. Jen Desmond, Hillary Newton, Ruth Briggs, Bethany Hilton. How had she never known? How come none of her teammates had ever mentioned it before? Did they all know? There's more, Cindy said. Jillian meandered from plot to plot, tracing her fingertips over the engravings on the stones. After another minute to take it all in, Cindy grabbed Jillian's hand and led her back up to the car. Coach Haggis watched from bloodshot eyes as the two girls climbed into the red car and drove away.
Up to no good, she grumbled from between yellowed teeth. She started up her station wagon and decided to track the two troublemakers. Just in case, she thought.
So you said there's more? Jillian said, breaking the silence that followed them from the graveyard. Cigarette in hand, Cindy looked back to her friend.
We're going to do something about that old bitch. It's time somebody did.
Like what?
Jillian was unsure where this whole setup was going.
Didn't we already go over this?
There's something I haven't told you yet.
Cindy took a drag from her smoke and then tossed it out the window. The sun had begun its late afternoon descent as the street lamps lining the streets birthed new shadows beneath their dull illuminations.
What? That coach is really a monster?
Again with the jokes, Cindy said. She shook her head and went right for the meat on the plate.
We know how to stop her. We know about Bethany Hilton's journal and her connection to Ms. Welks.
We who? Jillian asked. And who's Ms. Welks?
You really don't get around much, do you?
Cindy said.
We is Heather, Haley, Megan, and me. Ms. Welks is the old woman who lives in that junky shack at the end of my street.
You mean somebody actually lives in that thing?
Yes, Ms. Welks. She used to be the history teacher at Hollis Oaks back in the 60s and early 70s, but she was forced to resign just before the start of the school year. They said she was preaching for the devil.
This is starting to sound stupid, Jillian said. She didn't like where any of this was going. She was also hurt that the rest of her teammates were keeping her out of the loop.
Ms. Welks was teaching the Salem witch hunts differently than from the textbooks. She wasn't preaching evil or anything, but she was trying to show the whole awful thing from the perspective of the accused. The school didn't like it and said Ms. Welks was a bad influence on the students. She was forced out. The whole town pretty much turned their backs on her. She's lived like a hermit ever since.
So where does she fit into this equation of revenge you guys have apparently been plotting behind my back?
Oh, honey, Cindy said. We weren't excluding you to be rotten. We just didn't think you would believe or want to take part in any of this.
Okay, whatever.
Any of what? What the hell are we talking about?
Headlights bloomed to life behind them. A car was on their bumper.
What the fuck?
Cindy shouted. She looked in her rearview mirror.
Who is this asshole?
Jillian's guts went sour.
Signal them to go around, she said.
Cindy rolled down her window, stuck her arm out, and then waved it forward. The car behind them bumped into them, nudging the bumper.
Jillian screamed. To hell with this, Cindy said.
She stepped on the gas and quickly put space between them and the deranged follower. The pursuer was keeping up. The headlamps of the vehicle grew larger as the car approached the bumper again.
They're coming back, Jillian said.
The car rocked and threatened to fishtail, but held straight. Cindy pressed the pedal to the floor.
It stopped, Jillian said. The car.
Cindy let off the gas and glanced in the rearview mirror. They watched the vehicle that had struck them sit idling in the road and moved forward and turned down Crescent Street. Coach Haggis's meaty laugh filled the smoky interior of her station wagon as she diverted down the side street. She wasn't done fucking with these girls just yet. She took another swig from her Coors-filled thermos and swerved to miss the mailbox she was headed for.
What was that all about?
Jillian said. Her nerves were on end. She needed another cigarette. Without having to be told, Cindy lit two more, emptying her pack.
We've got to get the girls and go see Ms. Welks.
Half an hour later, all five girls were cramped into the compact car and headed to the crumbling home of the former history teacher, Ms. Welks.
So you guys have actually talked about this with this woman?
Jillian said, still riding shotgun.
Well, yeah,
Heather said, a slightly exaggerated flakiness to her tone.
We read about her in Bethany's journal.
Yeah, Bethany and Ruth were tired of Coach Haggis's bullshit and were trying to figure out a way to get her back, Megan said.
They were in Ms. Welks' class freshman year and thought that she might be able to help,
Haley said.
What were they looking for? And I thought Ms. Welks was just a teacher standing up for the witches of Salem. She wasn't exactly worshiping the devil, right?
Jillian said. Cindy took the lead again.
According to Bethany's journal, Ms. Welks was a witch. Or, let me rephrase that, is a witch. Now you're really losing me here, Jillian said.
She turned from the group and looked out at the darkness to gather her thoughts.
The girls waited. Jillian stared at the one-level shack approaching them in the headlights.
So this woman is a witch, and you guys have talked to her? So what are we doing now?
Jillian wasn't sure she wanted to know. Cindy pulled the car into the cracked driveway lined with sprouted weeds. She killed the engine, and the light died away.
We are going to get the spell Bethany Hilton and the girls from the championship team meant to use, and we're going to use it instead.
The five girls huddled together and moved forward as a team. Cindy and Jillian went up the faded brown steps, and the others gathered behind them. Cindy raised her hand to knock on the chipped red door. It opened before she made contact. Jillian drew a breath and took a step back. Cindy didn't flinch.
Ms. Welks, may we come?
A trembling, wrinkled hand adorned with gaudy gold jewelry and blood-red rings thrust a black candle wrapped with a yellowed piece of paper against Cindy's chest.
Take it. Do as you wish and leave me alone. My part is done.
But Ms. Welks... The door slammed in Cindy's face.
Guys, I think...
Haley said. Jillian left Cindy at the door. She couldn't wait to get as far away from this place as possible. She joined Haley at the end of the driveway. Heather followed. A station wagon, Coach Haggis's station wagon, was coming down the road. The street lamps highlighted the ugly junk box as it crept toward them. Jillian felt ill.
What do we do?
Heather whined. Cindy stepped toward them.
Gather around, quick, Cindy said.
Jillian, Haley, Heather, and Megan joined Cindy. The five formed a circle. Cindy unfurled the paper and handed her lighter along with the black candle to Megan.
Light this and hold it steady.
The wind died, seeming to sense their intentions. Megan lit the candle and held it out before Cindy. Cindy lifted the brittle, yellow paper beyond the floundering light of the candle and read aloud.
I summon the elements. I invoke them. I conjure them to do my bidding.
The four watchtowers behold, there shall be fear and guilt and retribution. There shall be submission and no pity.
Thou shalt be blinded by the fear, blinded by the pain, blinded by me, cursed by me, so shall it be.
A flash of lightning ripped through the night, spotlighting the homely features of Coach Haggis as she inched to a stop before the weed-infested driveway. An Olympian thunder boomed through the electrically charged air, and the smell of ozone was heavy on the stirring breeze.
What are you girls doing out here? That there is private property.
Coach Haggis's head leaned out the window.
We were just visiting Ms. Welks, Haley said.
The weeds in the pavement began to dance with the returning wind.
You think I'm stupid? Ms. Welks has been dead for 20 years. That house,
Coach Haggis paused,
and everything in it belongs to me, so get off of my property.
Jillian turned to Cindy for confirmation, for understanding, but saw only shock in her friend's glassy eyes.
Don't make me get out of this car. Now, get on out of here. Go home.
The girls rushed to the small Suzuki and piled in without a word.
You five have earned yourself an extra practice tomorrow.
Coach Haggis looked up toward the reopening sky as the rain began to fall in fat droplets. She smiled as Cindy pulled the car past her onto the road and yelled,
Practice tomorrow, rain or shine.
No one spoke a word as Cindy drove them home. She dropped Jillian off last. Jillian held her flooded hands between her knees.
What do you think she's planning for us tomorrow?
Nothing nice. Hopefully Miss Welk's spell works. Otherwise... Cindy placed a hand to her lips and shook her head. Jillian placed a hand on her friend's shoulder.
No matter what happens tomorrow, or even if nothing happens, we've got each other.
The storm raged through the night, not coming to an end until just after lunch the following day. It was an early release day, but they still had practice. The girls gathered on Wimbling Street in front of the old school a few minutes before practice.
Do you think it's possible?
Heather said.
What, that we've been talking to a woman who's been dead for 20 years? What are you, stupid?
Cindy spat.
Well, I never really saw her,
Megan said.
Yeah, she never let us in. Really, you're the only one who ever saw her up close. What do you think?
Haley said.
I think you've all been smoking drugs or huffing gas with Greg and Jackson Jennings,
Cindy replied. She crossed her arms over her chest and stared at the silent graves beyond the school. She wasn't about to admit she was scared shitless, too. Jillian stepped up behind her and placed her arms around her.
Hey, thanks for trying.
Tears rolled down Cindy's cheek as she half laughed, half cried.
I guess it didn't really work for Bethany either.
The rest of the girls joined in on the group hug. A dark familiar figure stepped out onto the practice field. The whistle of the damned blurted to life. The good times were over. The girls reassured each other with gentle squeezes.
picked up their gear, and headed across the street. "Get your dyke asses over here," the old crank shouted. Jillian walked next to Cindy, their shoulders slumped as they stepped onto the muddy field. "You thinking about practicing some witchcraft, hmm?" Coach said. Shock wavered in each of their eyes. "I didn't think your old coach knew about that shithole of a house now, did you, hmm?" Coach Haggis stalked around the girls as they huddled together, just like last night in Ms. Welk's driveway. "You ain't the first group of devious little cunts to try to curse me. You see that graveyard back there?" She turned and pointed at the hill of gray stones. "You know whose graves those are. You know what happened to my championship team, don't you?" Jillian wanted to run. "Those little bitches tried using some of that old witch's magic on me, too. But you know what I did? I killed the witch." There was something dark moving in the violent fits within Coach Haggis's bloodshot eyes. "That's right. I killed that old witch. And you see what happened to her little minion?" She stepped up to Cindy, getting right in her face. "Their little curse backfired. Mm-hmm. They lost our game, and then they lost their pathetic little chicken shit lives." Cindy grimaced as Coach towered over her, tears rolled down her cheeks. We... Coach Haggis pulled her fist back and brought it right into Cindy's nose. Blood exploded over her mouth. Jillian lunged to help Cindy and caught another right cross in her already blackened eye. A deep pain detonated within the sensitive wound. Jillian fell to the ground and clutched her face. How can she get away with this? Cindy kneeled before Jillian, holding her nose. Streaks of crimson crawled from between her fingers. Coach Haggis stared with a mad rage burning in her eyes at the three girls still standing and clutching one another. You filthy little whores are next. Lightning flashed across the gray sky. Thunder cracked and joined a strong gust that seemed to appear out of nowhere. There was movement beyond the fence. Jillian noticed first. Coach Haggis grabbed Heather's jersey, yanked her from her friends, and clubbed her across the head with her thick arm. Heather landed in the soppy grass and looked over at Coach Haggis's other two victims. She followed their gaze to the graveyard, immediately whimpering and scurrying backwards. Jillian looked. They stalked across the field, their dead eyes locked on Coach Haggis. Heather rose up, screamed, and ran. Megan and Haley followed suit. It was them. The starting lineup from 71. Coach Haggis spun around and gasped. Her eyes went wide. No. No, she mumbled, staggering backwards, her arms stretched out to impede the encroaching ghouls. Jillian and Cindy scooted to the side, holding on tight to one another. You, Bethany said. Her guttural voice seethed with rage. Maggots dropped from her mouth. No, you can't be. Coach Haggis stammered and fell on her fat ass, mud splashed up in her face. We finally get to see you one last time, Bethany said. The ghoulish girls, dressed in the tattered and charred remains of their 71 uniforms, turned their half-rotted faces toward Jillian and Cindy. We'll take it from here. Now go. Another flash of electricity cut through the pale sky, highlighting the squirming bugs in Bethany's left eye socket. She raised a skeletal arm in the direction of the little red Suzuki. Jillian helped Cindy to her feet. The sight of the dead girls approaching their tormentor scratched phantom icy claws down her spine. Regardless, Jillian was ready for that bitch to get hers. At the sidewalk, Jillian and Cindy stopped to watch Ms. Welk's curse play out. As for you, Bethany turned to the blubbering coach. You're coming with us. Ruth and Hillary circled around the frightened woman who had tormented them so much during their years together. They each grabbed an arm and began to drag her through the muddy field toward the cemetery. You can't. You can't. You're dead. You're dead. Coach Haggis cried as bony hands dug further into her fat wrists. They stopped at the fence. Bethany crouched down, looking at the coach with her one milky eye. So are you. The five ghouls lifted the solid mass of the bullying bitch above the sharp finial points atop the wrought iron fence and then dropped her down. The heavy body of Coach Haggis sat impaled upon the cemetery fence, her blood running out over the field where she had terrified young girls for the past 42 years. The starting lineup of the Hollis Oaks Field Hockey State Champions of 1971 returned to their earthly graves. What do we do? Jillian cried. It worked. It really worked. Cindy stared across the field. Cindy, we need to thank Miss Welks. What? You heard what Coach said. Miss Welks is dead. Cindy grabbed Jillian's arm. Come on. Jillian couldn't believe her eyes. Coach Haggis's dead body was displayed for the whole town to see. The shack at the end of the street came into sight. Cindy pulled into the driveway and jumped out of the car. Jillian followed her. Miss Welks? Miss Welks? Cindy pounded on the door.
What are we doing here? You heard Coach.
Knock it off, Jay. You were here last night. She talked to you too, remember?
Cindy twisted the knob and pushed the door open with her shoulder. The quaint, dust-covered room beyond lay as still as an old black-and-white photo. The hearth, like the rest of the room, sat cold and empty.
No, this can't be. Jay, you saw her.
I didn't see anyone, she lied.
But the fire in the fireplace, you saw that.
I don't know what I saw. Cindy covered her mouth, then put her back to the wall and slid down to her butt. She held a yellowed piece of paper in her hands.
I'm sorry, Jillian said. Whatever it was, whatever was here, it's over. We should leave. But how?
A police car pulled up along the sidewalk.
What are you girls doing up here? This is private property.
Cindy scrambled to her feet and joined Jillian in the doorway.
Nothing, officer. Sorry, it was just a dare.
I need you girls to get off this property right now.
Okay, sorry,
Cindy said. Jillian stepped out into the light rain. Without turning, she heard the whoosh of the fire stoke up behind them. She looked back. The flame wavered in the hearth.
Ladies, now, the officer said.
We're coming, Cindy said. Just a sec.
Jillian watched from the doorstep as Cindy stepped to the fire and tossed in the yellowed paper. A silhouette appeared before the flame. It turned toward her. Cindy joined her on the stoop and closed the door. The delicious death of Parker Stevens. Parker Stevens and his best friend Kyle Clark watched the shrieking, blood-spattered girl make her miraculous escape from the chainsaw-wielding creep wearing the skin mask. Parker wasn't easily unsettled by scary movies. He and Kyle had watched them all summer. Yet this one was poisoning the veins beneath his skin. He would not sleep easy tonight.
Shit, man,
Kyle said. He jumped up and switched on the bedroom light. The golden glow erased the dark spaces like a talisman to ward off the fear. Parker had never been so grateful in his life.
That was pretty friggin' scary,
Kyle said.
Yeah.
Kyle moved to the DVD player to shut off the movie and shivered.
Don't know about you, but it gave me the creeps for sure. Look at my arms.
His flesh was pimpled with goosebumps.
But you're the one with the long walk home through the woods, he reminded Parker.
The thought made Parker want to puke, or hide, or both.
I could see if my sister would give you a ride home.
No way in hell. The last thing Parker wanted was Kyle's 17-year-old sister, the one with the perfect ass and tits, to find out he didn't dare to walk alone because he was afraid that a man wearing someone else's face was going to pop out of the woods and chase him home.
Nah, man, I'll be fine.
He lied. Parker should never have agreed to another horror movie. He should have left after Back to the Future. Marty McFly's time traveling was certainly preferable to Leatherface's crazy squealing. He should have left before darkness fell. Now he had no choice. Parker Stevens hated fall. The start of school, his dad's dumb football buddies, like Mark Witzke, who always asked him if he was gay because he didn't like watching a bunch of dudes in tight pants play slap-ass with each other all day. The frozen ground, mornings at the bus stop that were frigid, the color slipping away from the world, and the sun checking out before supper. No, Parker preferred the good old summer sun and heat.
You want to walk halfway with me? Parker said.
Sure.
That's okay, man. You don't have to.
No, I'll come. I'm the one who talked you into staying for the movie.
Kyle picked his jacket up from the floor.
Kyle?
Kyle's sister, Alicia, appeared in the doorway. Parker tried not to ogle her, but he was powerless. Her long blonde hair with violet streaks hanged over the light blue t-shirt stretched across her breast. Her dark blue stretch jeans hugged her hips. Parker's mind began to wander down a dirty daydream. Dad needs you to go with him to Uncle Charlie's house, the angel in the doorway said. Her gorgeous brown eyes met Parker's. Hey, Parker. He cleared his throat.
Hey, Alicia,
he managed. She smiled. She knew the spell he was under. She was the sorceress. He cursed her for being so hot and for being so evil.
Why do I have to go? Kyle said.
Alicia's devilish grin dropped. Her brow furrowed. Parker thought he liked her annoyed look just as much as her smile.
I don't know.
He said something about that desk Uncle Charlie said you could have.
Oh, awesome.
Kyle tempered his enthusiasm.
Sorry, Park. Maybe we can drop you off on our way.
Parker looked toward Alicia and shrugged.
Nah, man. Don't worry about it. I'll just take the path.
I'll just take the path. What an idiot.
Parker blew into his hands to fend off the chill of the October night. He imagined what could have been had he just let Kyle ask Alicia to drive him home. She might have teased him a little, bit her bottom lip, told him he was cute for a 14-year-old, asked him if he had a girlfriend, or if he'd ever Frenched a girl before. He had, Molly Beasley last summer, but that was neither here nor there.
Bzzz, bzzz,
click, click, click. He buttoned his brown corduroy jacket up over the black sweatshirt with the Anarchy logo that he borrowed from Kyle. The warm summer night had died fast, too fast, giving way to fall's creeping bite. He rubbed his hands together to combat the annoying chill.
Bzzz, bzzz, click, click, click.
Hello? He cried out. Kyle, is that you, man? He listened, but he heard only the autumn leaves dancing their crisp ballad across the trail. He stuffed his hands in his pockets and regained his stride. Click, click, click. This time the sound froze him to the earth. Parker puffed out his bony chest as best he could, made his voice sound deeper than it was, and shouted, "This shit isn't funny! Come on out!"
Bzzz, bzzz.
The awful buzzing was coming from the shadows ahead of him. The insect noise seemed to be in collusion with the clicking sounds emanating from the clump of half-naked maple trees to his left.
These are the woods. There's supposed to be all sorts of stupid insects and animals out here. Plenty of them are nocturnal.
He cursed himself for being such a wuss. Images of movie posters plastered on Kyle's bedroom walls, Michael Myers, The Lost Boys, The Fly, picked this moment to attack his anxious mind.
"Boy,"
a raspy voice whispered. Parker's false bravado wilted under the bucket of ice that the voice spilled down his spine. He stepped back.
Who said that?
Click, click, click.
Bzzz, bzzz.
The awful insect noises multiplied and encircled him. The clicking in the trees to his left jumped to his right, then above, then behind. The buzzing from somewhere in front of him was now behind him, and the autumn carpet beneath his feet crinkled at his back. Parker wished he'd left before dark.
"Boy,"
the voice repeated, more clearly. The raspy voice was feminine, but younger sounding than Bart Simpson's heavy smoking aunts, Patty and Selma. And then, there she was. Parker could see her. She was up ahead on the trail, loose strands of long hair swayed around her with the night wind. The trees above wavered, shafts of moonlight filtered through the branches. A beam of white moonlight undulated like a spotlight around her. She was dressed in a tattered rag, a rope of some kind tethered around her thin waist. Two stick-thin arms rested at her side. He could not see her face.
"Boy,"
she repeated.
"Come to us."
"Us?" Parker felt the flesh on his arms try to crawl from the still-growing muscles and bones beneath. He spun around and saw two more small forms. They were hunched over and holding their hands close to their chest, watching, waiting.
"What do you want from me?"
Parker said.
"Bzzz,
click, click, click."
They were making those noises. What were they?
He heard a rustling to his left. He caught two more sets of eyes staring out at him from the dark.
Bzzz, bzzz, click, click, click. "Boy,"
the bizarre girl called again.
"We want, bzzz, bzzz, you to come to us."
"Who are you?" Parker said, not sure he wanted to know.
"I am, bzzz, bzzz, Krona."
"Krona? What kind of name was that?"
I can't. I gotta get home. My mom's got supper ready and I'm already running late."
The words fell from his lips like the last leaves of the season. Death was coming.
Click, click, click.
Bzzz, bzzz. Twigs snapped, leaves crunched, and bare branches knocked against one another. Parker slowly turned, doing a 360 before his gaze returned to Krona.
"Hey, I don't want any trouble. I just want to go home." "Boy, bzzz, bzzz. You are not going anywhere," Krona said. "What's that buzzing sound? How are you doing that?"
Before he could get an answer, his arms and shoulders were snatched from behind, but not by human hands.
"What? No, no, no!"
He fought against them, but was thrown to the ground. The wind knocked from his lungs. Two impossibly large and hairy insect legs with their claws at their tips reached for his mouth.
"No," Krona cried. "Not yet."
Bzz, bzz, bzz. Parker, eyes wide, heart pounding, watched as they closed in around him.
"God, what are they?"
The children looked half-human, half-insect. The two that shoved him to the ground had antenna protruding from their dark foreheads, two mandibles opened and closed in rhythm to his accelerated heart. A flicking, drooling tongue darted in and out toward him. He couldn't see their eyes. Do they have eyes? His attention was harpooned by the sight of the one called Krona. She floated up, up, up and off the path. She moved toward him through the chilled air.
"What are you?"
Parker squirmed, but the two things that had knocked him down sunk their claws further into his flesh and pinned him in place. Krona landed on top of him. His chest felt like it had last July when Kyle held him underwater in Lynn Stanley's swimming pool, tight and deflated.
Her hind legs jutted out from the makeshift garment that covered the rest of her. Parker was shocked that they were actually human legs. Her arms, however, resembled the insect legs of his attackers. They were shorter and ended in three clawed fingers. Behind her, a set of wings fluttered. The loud buzzing sound they made was nearly deafening at this range.
"We only wanted you to play with us," Cronus said,
her voice seethed with malevolence.
"Bzzz, bzzz."
Her wings fluttered angrily. Two large, red, sack-like fly eyes gazed down upon him from her squished face. Beneath the hair-covered hose thing protruding from under her eyes, he could see two quivering black lips. Parker shut his eyes tight, not wanting to look upon her hideous face any longer. His breathing came in hitches as the tears flooded his cheeks.
"Leave me alone, please." "Look at me," Krona demanded.
"Bzzz, bzzz." He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to see her eyes again, or the hose-like thing reaching out below them.
"Then I will make you see."
Without warning, Krona tore away the tender flesh that covered Parker's baby blues. Parker's screams barreled through the black forest. Forced to gaze upon Krona's enlarged orbs, a new level of fear laid to waste any remaining semblance of Parker's resolve. He was like a decaying animal carcass at the will of a thousand maggots. Krona stabbed her clawed fingers through his corduroy jacket and into his scrawny shoulders. He screamed. The physical pain and mental torment coalesced into one overwhelming nightmare. He tried closing his non-existent eyelids but was rewarded with more pain. Krona's mandibles stretched and revealed what looked like a hairless caterpillar. The tongue-like thing inside of her mouth pulled back into itself and then darted forward repeatedly. It oozed a shimmering fluid that Parker witnessed trickle down the protrusion. He watched as the bubble took form at the hairless tube's tip. Subconsciously knowing what was coming, a video on the common housefly he had seen in Mr. Huber's science class last year flashed in a microburst through his spiraling mind. He stared helplessly as the thing called Krona regurgitated the remains of her last meal onto the lower half of his face and into his mouth. Click, click, click. Bzzz, bzzz. Parker's face felt like it had been placed upon a red-hot stovetop. The taste filling his mouth, at first a fecal sludge, became nothing as the soft pink tissue that had seconds ago been his tongue melted away. He watched the grotesque thing sitting on top of him rub its two diminutive arms together. Krona unleashed a second glob of acidic vomit over the same space as the last. Parker choked on chunks of deliquesced tissue and enamel as his mouth caved in upon itself. Certain death was his lone savior from this nightmare, and he focused his unblinkable gaze up at the swaying treetops. He was grateful for the blood that had begun to blur his vision. He was ready to give himself over to the other side to end this suffering when something shot into the back of his throat and landed with a gentle thud that triggered his gag reflex. The vacuuming of his dissolving mouth stole him from the promised comfort of death and placed him firmly back into this purgatory. Krona retracted the sucking instrument from his esophagus and regurgitated upon her clawed fingers and rubbed them together. Parker's mind unraveled. He began his descent into the black vortex of whatever lies beyond life. The two bug children hidden in the bushes came forward, giggling and clicking. Krona made room for her kin. All five of the half-human, half-insect creatures descended upon the twitching body of Parker Stevens, all regurgitating, rubbing, and sucking. The last sounds he heard were those of the nocturnal jungle around him, which sang a chorus of devotion and wonder, and of his own delicious death.
"I'm in here. I'm in here. Somewhere. I'm listening. I hear voices. I see faces with my eyes closed. Happy, sad, broken, like my eyes, my voice. Did I earn this?" And then he pulled the knife from me. "Are they talking about me? A knife? They were supposed to come home. Hurt. Sorrow deep as it is heartbreaking. What about the knife? But it all fades, drying up and evaporating like beads of water on skin after a swim in July. There's the beeps. The machine that makes me be. Right? Isn't that it? I'm in a bed, wired and tapped to the gills. And I'm awake, dreaming. And awake, undead. Oh, God. Did I deserve this? I'm in here, somewhere. Still hung up on the knife. I think it was me. Baby never made it. Oh, it would have killed her. She's beautiful. So beautiful. Baby? What baby? Whose baby? Who's beautiful? I want to scream, but no one can hear me except me. I drift away, swimming in total darkness. I think of the knife and feel its heat in my stomach. My, me, baby,
vegetable.
Oh, it's the right thing. She wouldn't have wanted to stay like this.
Who? Stay like what? Hear me. Hear me. I'm in here.
Silence. A walk on the beach after dark. Just the beeps. Just the machines. How do I...
Baby never made it?
I love you, honey. I'm so sorry. Goodbye. In my dream, they're pulling my wires, pulling the plug, and I see the faces again. All of them. So many of them. So familiar, yet something's wrong. No. No, 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 no. Where's it all going? Come back. Miss you, Mom. I love you.
Who? Who's Mom? Who's leaving?
And then I see them. All of them. My husband, Greg. Our two girls, Mei Lin and Rumor. And the baby. My belly. My little one. And the man in the mask by the car. I turn and run, and the knife dives into my shoulder. My neck. My neck. My neck. My belly. The sounds come from outside. Beeping, screaming, crying. My babies. Don't take me from my babies. I'm in. It's all swirling up. Up, up, into the white. Beep. The bad one. The long one. The last one. The beep that carries on, holding a singular solid note until they unplug the machine. The vegetable on the table. The time of death, 5:34 p.m.
I'm in here. I'm still in here. Somewhere.
Henry. Use the razor. The nice new one on the top shelf. Henry knew he shouldn't do it. He knew the voice was bad, just like he knew he shouldn't touch himself when he thought of his cousin, Deidre. No one told you these things. You just knew. He stared long and hard at the shiny silver razor on his dad's shelf. It was next to the bottle of Aquavelva and the two sticks of Old Spice deodorant, behind the bathroom mirror. Henry took a deep breath and closed the vanity. His acne-covered face glared back at him. Ugly, cratered, and leaking. He hated his face, or at least the zits that had multiplied since the start of the school year. Being 13 sucked. He knew Acne Explosion was ruining his summer-long dream of asking Angela Masters out. Now, he didn't dare stand within 100 feet of her. He was afraid she'd gasp in horror and run from sight of his hideous geological face map. Even worse, she might stare at him, unable to look away from the disgusting thing he'd become.
Open the mirror and take the razor.
Henry thought of Angela and gave in to the voice. He placed a sweaty palm along the edge of the mirror with the slightest hesitation. He felt the largest of the exuding pustules throb. He opened the vanity, and with trembling fingers, reached up and gripped the silver handle to his father's shiny new Gillette Fusion. 5 glorious, acne-slicing blades of sheer release whispered to him of freedom and cleanliness. He stared at the perfect line of gleaming razors as they shimmered under the cabinet's bulb.
Freedom and cleanliness,
the voice repeated. Henry held the razor in his right hand and reached up to the valley of sore, wet spots on his face. His stomach lurched. His rage, on the other hand, demanded he place the finely tuned blades to the painful pox altering his complexion and be done with it. His mouth was dry. He swallowed hard and made his move. Knock, knock, knock.
Henry, are you still in there?
The razor's edge sat flush with the top of his cheek.
Yeah, Ma, still in here,
he said.
Jesus Christ. Well, don't be too much longer. You know how your father likes to shower before he goes to bed. Okay, I'll finish up,
he said. Henry listened. He heard the floorboards in the hallway creak as his mother walked away. He returned his attention to the job at hand. He pressed the razor against the muddled skin.
Hey, jerkface, what are you doing in there? Pounding your pud?
Shit.
His brother's voice startled him. Henry moved the razor and closed the mirror. A half-centimeter nick on his face smiled its crimson mouth back at him.
Well, I gotta take a shit, man. Come on already.
Now he'd have to hurry.
I'll be out in a minute. Hey, whatever, just hurry it up,
Charlie said.
Damn it.
He wished they would all just go away.
They don't want us to do it. They like us being the ugly duckling.
The voice. Henry wondered if his mind had finally broken. All these hormones, all of these goddamn changes, like the hard-ons, the sex dreams, his voice. The chirping choir in his head was supposed to stay in his head. He focused on the razor and pressed it against his cheek. Sweat pooled in the backs of his knees. His palms were slick. He worried the razor would clatter to the sink. He prayed for Charlie to pound on the door, or for his father to come down for a shower. He listened for his mother's heavy footfalls.
Look at our face. Look at our shame. How grotesque.
How vile! Such a pity a good-looking boy is cursed with such a disgusting complex.
The voice spoke truth. He was gross. He was vile. He should be handsome like Charlie or his father. Instead, he was an ugly, greasy, pus-spewing mess.
Wipe it clean.
Henry pressed the blades into the pimple-covered flesh. He felt the sharp pinch followed by a cool sensation. A trickle of blood escaped from beneath the blades and ran towards his chin. The dribble of blood sliding down Henry's face crawled over the series of whiteheads in its path. The sight of blood and acne boiled his anger over the lip of his self-control. Henry, still pressing his father's shiny 5 blades into his cheek, pulled the instrument down and screamed. The blade sunk in too deep. Rather than shear off the top layers of littered dermis as he'd planned, the razor hung from the blood-gushing wound. He let go of the handle, his hand trembling, his face burning and hyperventilated.
"We're almost done. Pull the razor free."
Henry gripped the handle. A wave of euphoria rolled over his body, a sense of calm, a sense of accomplishment. He cracked a crooked smile at the mirror and ripped the razor from its sunken place in his ruined flesh. He dropped the shaver into the sink, now coated in crimson. A chunk of flesh clung to the razor, stuck between the blades. The white light above him intensified, threatening his balance. Henry gripped the sink. The flap of bloody skin reminded him of the divot he'd chunked out of the ground when his father had taken him and Charlie to the golf course in Manchester last weekend. Knock, knock, knock.
"Henry? Henry, are you all right?"
his mother asked. She was already hysterical.
"Everett! Finish before father comes. He doesn't want us to succeed. He wants us to stay ugly." "Henry! Everett! I can hear him. He won't open the door."
"What's going on in there?" his father's voice boomed from behind the barrier. Henry reached into the sink and cleared the red, fleshy chunk from the razor. Dropping the ugly, ruined skin to the floor carried an odd flood of good feelings. He was doing the right thing.
"One more time and we'll be free."
Henry pressed the blades into the top of his other cheek, the one still taunting him with its redness and white flag-waving volcanoes, ready to burst their ulcerated mounds over his face for the world. A world featuring the beautiful Angela McMasters to see.
"Bam! Bam! Break it down, Everett!"
his mother commanded his father. The door exploded inward. Henry pulled the razor down his cheek, using both hands this time to drag the series of fine blades all the way down, freeing the other side of his face from the homeliness with which he'd been cursed. This time he did not scream. He turned to his family and tried to smile, but found he'd ruined the muscles with which to do so. His mother screamed for them all.
"We're beautiful."
Henry wondered if Angela McMasters would agree. Something lost.
"I'm just a hunk of hunk and burn in love."
"Hey, Dad," I said. I knew he was checking in whenever the king began to sing. I guess I was still usually looking for him, too, flipping through the oldies stations and all. Still, what are the oldies stations playing these days? Michael Jackson, Hall & Oates, Madonna? It wasn't a surefire thing that Elvis, the pelvis, as Dad was always referred to him, hands in the air, shaking his hips in the way that always made me laugh, could be found on the airwaves. "Yeah, I guess I need a laugh," I said. "How's Greg?" I ask, as I always do. "Good, I imagine. And Elvis and Roy?" "Roy Orbison, another of Dad's favorites. The back roads are dark. My drive home isn't long, just about right for a check-in and a crying session from time to time. I imagine him driving and me riding shotgun. I pass Fuller's Market. He used to take me with him every time he went to pick up his cigarettes, beer, and whatever else Mom needed. He'd have on the oldies station, which was still playing 50s and 60s then. He'd tap his foot and sing along to every song between sips from the coffee mug he kept filled with Coors Light. I never got my license until after he passed. I never got to drive him anywhere except crazy with my mohawk and the safety pin in my ear. Getting to chauffeur him around for a change, that would have been cool. I've got a Beach Boys CD I definitely would have put in for him. He probably doesn't know the words to Maneater or Billie Jean. I can hear him sing Good Vibrations. He'd do that low vocal part. He always seemed to get a kick out of going low. Elvis has left the building. Burning Love gives way to some crappy James Taylor tune. I'm not ready to lose the connection yet, so I grab the CD booklet from round the seat and grab the Beach Boys CD and put it in. Round, round, get around, I get around. There, just a couple more minutes. I start to sing along. My voice cracks. I imagine us doing a duet. The tears start crawling down my cheeks. I'm pulling into my driveway when the song ends. I kill the engine and wipe my cheeks with the sleeve of my sweatshirt. It's nice to know that sometimes, even if just for a few minutes, you can get back something you've lost.
Ballad of the Best-Selling Author. Zombies of Death. Apocalypse Now, Zombie War.
Heartless in Indiana, Zombies of the Heartland. Everywhere Jackson looked, there seemed to be a new zombie book. What happened to horror literature? What happened to stories about other monsters? He wasn't sure which offended him more, the pretty vampires of Teen Beat or the umpteen million new zombie novels gracing every available horror space at Bertrand's Book Nook. "Bert," Jackson called from the back aisle. Jackson Benoit had been coming in since the day the place opened back up in 2004. He was Bert's number one customer, usually making special orders, those of which he always picked up the day they came in. The orders were mostly horror novels by authors he knew Bertrand wasn't really familiar with. Nate Kenyon, John Horner Jacobs, Robert S. Wilson. But he'd happily order for Jackson, who would come running, rain or shine, to pick his orders up within an hour of receiving his phone call letting him know they were in. Jackson's big problem was his beloved genre's oversaturated love fest with all things zombie. In fact, the last and only zombie novel he had purchased was The Rising by Brian Keene. "Why do you keep putting up all these zombie displays? How about a tribute to the two Richards?" Jackson said.
"The two who?"
"The two Richards, Richard Matheson and Richard Layman. I could make some suggestions on which novels to display."
"Maybe. I don't know," Bertrand said as he wandered down the romance aisle, not really listening to Jackson's suggestions as he strode up next to him.
The man looked absolutely disgusted, staring at the new Yolanda Jackson Zombies of New Orleans series. A number of customers had made similar grimaces when passing by the display. The covers were quite gruesome. They featured one zombie or another half-rotted and embracing their current meal, usually which was in the form of a sexy female. They were like mock versions of the romance covers across the aisle.
"It just pisses me off," Jackson said. "You know why Stephen King steers clear of zombies?"
"Because he already wrote Cell?" Bertrand said.
"Well, okay, he did write that. But for the most part, his horror mind is so far beyond..."
Jackson's rant was interrupted by the sound of the jingle-jangling bells over the entrance door. Bert must know this guy, he thought, as the store owner rushed to the well-dressed gentleman standing by the cash register. The man wore a long black trench coat, slick black slacks, black-rimmed hipster glasses, and a navy blue button-up shirt which he seemed to have forgotten to button all the way up, as the top four buttons were left undone, exposing a well-defined bare chest.
What a jerk-off,
Jackson thought as he picked up a ghost anthology, feigning interest in the trade paperback while checking out the goon by the register.
"You must be Bertrand. I'm Scott Pendergrass, author of Zombie University," Bertrand said.
Scott Pendergrass smiled at the acknowledgement. He held out a black-gloved hand and shook Bertrand's.
"My publisher told me I was all set to do a book signing here Saturday."
Jackson fought the urge to throw up in his mouth.
"I received a shipment of your novel yesterday. Jenny contacted me this morning to make sure I had gotten them all."
"Ah, Jenny. She is good.
I trust we'll be okay to start at noon," the trench coat said.
Jackson saw the man eyeballing him from behind his trendy frames.
"Oh, yes. I'll have that space in the front corner."
Bertrand pointed to the area directly behind Mr. Pendergrass and currently filled with a reading for kids display. "Cleared and ready for you to meet and greet your readers."
"Perfect," the trench coat said. "I have some things to tend to tonight, a small gala at the Armory. Can I swing by and discuss some ideas with you tomorrow morning? Say 10:30?
"Well, I don't usually open until 11, but sure, that would be fine."
"Great," the trench coat said with a giant, perfectly white-toothed smile. Jackson saw the man eyeing him again and went back to the ghost anthology. "He's probably waiting for me to recognize him. Asshole."
"We'll see you in the morning then."
The trench coat shook Bert's hand again, nodded in Jackson's direction, and headed back out the door.
"Come on," Jackson said as he stared toward the register.
"I don't want to hear it. And besides, you don't have to come."
"You are the worst,"
Jackson said. He slammed the ghost anthology on the counter.
"I have to make a living, Jackson. Zombie books sell. They're hot right now, and so is Mr. Pendergrass."
"Oh, God. Spare me."
Jackson rolled his eyes.
"I'm sorry, but Zombie University is a huge seller. They're even talking about adapting it for the big screen."
"Barf.
And did you see the way that a-hole was dressed? He's full of himself and he's unoriginal."
Jackson pulled his pack of Camels from his leather jacket, placing one between his thin lips. A silent rage simmered in his veins. Jackson was fucking sick of rehashing the whole subgenre of living dead bullshit with Bertrand. Probably as much as Bert was of hearing it. In light of the changes in Jackson's recent home life, there were things he didn't think Bert could comprehend. Hell, he'd had a hard enough time making the impossible adjustments.
"So I'm guessing you won't be in on Saturday?"
Bertrand said.
"Yeah, but I'll probably swing by tomorrow.
Maybe I'll come in before you close up and sabotage his table.
All right, Jackson, just cool it.
Jackson stared at Bert for a moment longer. He didn't have to please the mindless masses. Hey, have a good night, Jackson. Say hi to your mother for me, huh?
Mm.
Jackson grunted. He thought he'd caught a hint of suspicion on Bertrand's face. Had Bert been gauging his response to the salutation? Paranoia, it was part of him now. Without another word, he stepped in the doorframe, pulled a gold Zippo from the back pocket of his jeans, and lit his cigarette. He let the door close behind him. He turned into the slight breeze and strolled down the sidewalk under the streetlights. He thought of his mother and wondered when Bertrand was going to start to press him about why she hadn't been around. She was as much a romance novel-aholic as he was a horror fiend. For now, him picking up her Nora Roberts and Penelope Ward novels alongside his Samhain horror purchases seemed to be doing the trick. Jackson stopped at the corner of Main and Water Street. A newspaper flapped on the bench beside him. He peeked at the photograph gracing the front page. It was of a scraggly-looking blonde kid in a Perry the Platypus t-shirt. He hadn't wanted to read the headline. Justin Goodman. He didn't want to know the kid's name. The next morning, Jackson Benoit waited outside Bertrand's book nook, smoking a cigarette in the crisp Friday morning air. He had had bad dreams last night. He'd tossed and turned half the night, haunted by the scraggly-looking blonde kid. He'd made one good decision early this morning. The next one he brought home would be more deserving. The door down the street opened and the trench coat stepped out dressed nearly the same as the day before. Long black coat, trendy dark-rimmed frames, slick black shoes, and what looked like leather pants? And again, he sported with the half-buttoned shirt and bare chest look. Tool. Jackson waited for the trench coat to cross the road and then began his way toward the bookstore door. The bells announced his arrival. I thought you were coming by later to set up your booby traps, Bertrand said. Ha ha, very funny. Have you even read that jerk's crappy book? Jackson said. He leaned against the counter by the register and watched Bert carefully place copies of Zombie University upon the table in the front counter. Well, no, but my boyfriend did and he loved it, Bertrand said. He picked up a large white banner from behind the table. Yeah, well, I've met Mark, and he doesn't seem to have very good taste in general. Jackson moved to help Bert with the banner. That's real sweet of you, Jackson, Bertrand said. Jackson grabbed one end while Bert climbed atop the little red wooden chair behind the table. As Bert tacked his corner, Jackson got a good look at what the banner read. Come meet Scott Pendergrass, New York Times best-selling author of Zombie University. Saturday, October 18th, starting at 12 p.m. I can't believe I'm helping you put this trash up, Jackson said. Bert pushed the little red chair in front of him. Jackson stepped up and pushed the tack in place. I don't think I'll ever forgive myself. Bertrand watched him get down, then offered a smile. I think you'll live. Thanks for your help. It's the least I could do for all the bitching and moaning I do around here. Well, thanks all the same. Bertrand went around to the register and bent down. Jackson saw him pull out two more stacks of Zombie University. Did my new lock and key come in today? He said. Of course not. I would have called. You know that. I thought you might have been all worked up over your new boyfriend and just forgot to call me. What are you, jealous? Bertrand said. Yeah, I'm jealous all right. I'm jealous that some nice New York publisher decided to give you that goon money, and probably a lot of it, to put out a pile of his regurgitated plot lines and uninspired death scenes involving the lamest creatures of all time. I think I've heard this one before, Bertrand said. I blame two things. The Walking Dead and all the idiots who worship that show, Bertrand said. Instead of the graphic novels, yes, Jackson said. Well, just so you know, I enjoy that show. Mark can't stand to watch it, but he absolutely loves this book. Bertrand picked up the top copy of Scott Pendergrass's novel. Jackson felt a rage boil up within him. The rage from last night's dream. Well, that's because you guys are a couple of... The bells above the door jingled as two teenage girls dressed in skinny jeans and band t-shirts came babbling in from the cold. Bertrand gave Jackson a sharp look of disapproval before smiling wide and welcoming the two girls to his shop. Hi, Peggy. Hi, Michelle. Both girls squealed as they saw the table and banners set up. Oh my God, he's really coming, the first one with the purple hair and the dark eyeliner said. The second, shorter of the two, with blonde pigtails and wearing an old-school Motley Crue Shout at the Devil t-shirt, turned to Bert. You are gonna let us meet him first, right, Bertie? Jackson had the anger of 1,000 killer bees coursing through his blood. Without saying goodbye, he made his way back out the door. Jackson was stalking the trench coat, a.k.a. Scott Pendergrass, a.k.a. Mr. Pretentious and Mr. Unoriginal. The New York Times best-selling author was perfect.
He couldn't be certain until it was done, but Jackson didn't think this clueless fuck would cost him one wink of sleep. So far, he'd followed the trench coat to Jackie's Diner, then to Barnes & Noble, and now to the local strip joint, the Pink Slip. The loser was probably in there with the horny and the homely, eating up all the attention he could garner from the good-looking but desperate dancing girls. He could picture it now.
Trixie, what do you do for a living?
Cindy,
I bet he's a big-shot lawyer.
Trenchcoat, actually, ladies, I'm a New York Times best-selling author. 2 hours had passed. The Trenchcoat remained inside. Jackson stood silent and frozen at the end of the block. With his back against the street lamp, he blew into his numb hands. He cursed himself for not dressing better for the chilly evening. The cold chunks of brass in his inside pocket wasn't helping matters. The jerk wasn't coming out anytime soon. Jackson shoved off from the cold post and headed toward the front entrance of the Pink Slip. An alcohol and sweat perfume performed a blitzkrieg on his sense of smell while the dimly lit interior added to the sleazy visual effect. He could see Henry Simmons and Joel Packard sitting front and center before the sorry excuse for a stage. Ginger Red, who had graduated with him 2 years ago under the name Rebecca Howard, was giving the two wasted collegiate boys a show. Her breasts were modest, but she did have an ass to kill for. Jackson couldn't help but stare as he wandered over to the bar. Carla Tuttle had his whiskey sour waiting for him.
"Ain't seen you in a piece," she said.
Carla was a decent-looking mother of four in her mid-40s. She was dressed in a form-fitting black dress, her long black hair done up in a bun, strands of it hanging playfully around her pretty but plain face.
"Yeah, I've been pretty busy," Jackson said.
Truth was, he'd embarrassed himself during a private dance with Cindy a month back. She'd taken his cash for the lap dance slash hand job combo, but slapped him across the face and sent him away after he tried to slip his fingers in her. Really, it was just a combination of too much to drink and a simple miscommunication. In his inebriated condition, he allowed himself to fall all the way into the fantasy. Cindy wasn't into it and let him know the hard way. He hadn't had the balls to apologize for his pathetic actions that night or show his face since. Carla mixed him a second drink as she watched him down the first.
"You must be knee-deep in that book you're writing, huh?"
He had started the book, the story of a lonely man who takes a woman and, well, that was all he had so far.
"Yeah, it's coming along."
Carla poured herself a shot of Jaeger and threw it down the hatch.
"What kind of story is it anyway?"
"Horror," he said, looking at her ass as she turned to grab a rag.
"Oh yeah? What's it about? Vampires? Zombies? You ever see that show The Walking Dead?"
"Ugh, naturally. Fucking zombies and Twilight." He wanted to tell her, "Yes, Carla, I'm writing the next great zombie apocalypse series where two pretty people stumble across one another and fall in love amidst a dying world plagued by some government experiment gone horribly wrong. It's fucking beautiful and goddamn pointless." And it was fucking horseshit. Instead, he slid the empty glass to the side as she placed a fresh one in front of him.
"Yeah, something like that."
"Cool," she said. "You know I'm going to want a signed copy, right?" Jackson took the second whiskey sour and said, "Thank you, Carla." He turned back around to scan amid the sea of trash for a sight of the trench coat. It was hard to make out details in the gloom of the booths and the collection of county trash gathered within them. If this is the start of the zombie apocalypse, I hope to hell they get everyone in this shit town first. He let his mind do what it did best when he let it roll. They might barge through the entrance, moaning, arms outstretched, reaching desperately for the living. The first wave would come in stiff-legged and rigid, eyes staring into and through the plethora of U.S. waste gathered in the desolate slea shed. Henry Simmons and Joel Packard would spin around half-drunk, being caught completely off guard and probably grabbing at one another in desperation. Rebecca Howard, or Ginger Red, would stumble from the stripper pole onto her perfect ass before trying to scuttle back from the front of the shitty little stage as the first few zombies stumbled toward her and the collegiate blowholes. Jackson smiled at the images that played in his mind as he continued to scan the darkened room. After a few brief seconds, his gaze landed upon the slicked back hair and trendy black frames. Sure enough, there was Cindy and Trixie hovering around the big shot. Behind his tipped glass of auburn-tinted liquid courage, Jackson Benoit's eyes grew mean, matching the bitter burn trickling down his throat. He allowed his imagination to continue. The trench coat would shit his pants once he saw the real Walking Dead filing in. One decaying, maggot-dripping and rotten-flesh-dropping soul after another. He would grab Cindy by her tattooed arms and place her before him, a shield against the big green machine he had sold his own soul for. He was a coward in the living flesh, ready to be devoured.
Trixie and Cindy would unleash spine-shredding screams as gray-skinned arms of the dead would shatter through the tinted window next to their booth. Another horde would spill in over the initial wave, decaying flesh-covered appendages breaking off from their attached forms, soft and easy, like the branches of a long-since-rotted tree left for dead in the deepest part of the woods. Putrid little blue fingers would hook all three, Cindy, Trixie, and the trench coat, in the corners of their mouths and drag them into the dead masses, contaminating their tongues with the taste of putrefaction and their noses with the smell of spoiled meat. Just like, Jackson thought of his basement. He had to down another whiskey sour to shake his mind free. The still-alive Cindy's head shifted in his direction. Shit. He spun around and faced the counter. Carla was out back, leaving him alone to face the consequences of his past transgressions. He could see Cindy's determined approach reflected in the mirror behind the bar. Cindy's voice cut through the Billy Squire song blaring over the speakers, sharp, yet holding a hint of hurt. What the fuck, Jackson? He turned to face her. Her brown eyes looked black in the shadows. Her tattooed arms were folded over her heaving chest. Her plump bosom was stuffed into a tight white t-shirt that was filled with the slashes exposing tantalizing amounts of the soft flesh beneath. She looked amazing. Where the hell have you been? What? You don't answer calls? She said. My phone was disconnected 2 weeks ago. I haven't had the money to pay him, he said. Fuck you, Jackson, she said. Her eyes glistened as the tears threatened to fall. Look, he started. Is there a problem here? Scott Pendergrass said. He stepped up behind Cindy, placing his arm around her shoulders. Oh, fuck me, you have got to be kidding. Jackson wanted to put an end to this right now. He wasn't ready to deal with Cindy, and he certainly did not need this arrogant piece of shit meddling in his affairs. Listen, I don't think this is any of your business. Why don't you go back to your table and your little I'm-a-big-shot-author ego trip? Ah, so you do know who I am, he said. Pendergrass's perfect smile shone through the bar's dimness, a beacon of excruciating fluorescent light in the dreary underworld. And you have been following me all day, am I right? Fuck off, Jackson said. He turned his back, downed his drink, and got up to leave. Pendergrass reached out with a gloved hand and grabbed Jackson by the forearm. Hey, don't walk away from me, you little shitbag. Jackson threw a wide punch. He aimed for the trendy frames, but his haymaker was easily blocked and countered. The trench coat stopped the wild swing and landed a right cross of his own. Jackson's brain shook, and the stars came out early. He dropped to the floor. Cindy slapped Pendergrass. Who the fuck do you think you are? This isn't any of your goddamn business, she said. Jackson watched through his wobbly vision as Pendergrass grabbed her by the wrists. Don't you ever touch me, whore. Cindy yanked her arm free and came back with a fist, doing what Jackson had intended to do. She caught Mr. Fancy Fuck by surprise and knocked his hipster glasses to the floor. Pendergrass's brow furrowed, his teeth bared, upper lip twitching, and he was set to explode like a rocket into the night. He slugged Cindy with a closed fist and knocked her down next to Jackson. Jackson staggered to his feet. Pendergrass drew back his leg and kicked Jackson's wobbly legs out from under him. That's about enough, mister, Carla said. There was a ch-ch sound as the woman behind the bar pumped the shotgun in her hands, then raised it up with the twin barrels aimed right between the eyes of Scott Pendergrass. Whoa, 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 he said. He raised the palms of his leather gloves up for Carla to see. They both swung on me first. I don't give a shit. You hit one of my girls and one of our friends. Now you get the fuck out of my joint or I swear to God I'll blast these shells into that smug face of yours so that it decorates the floor. All right, all right. Jesus Christ. I just need to get my glasses. Scott Pendergrass started to bend for the little black frames. Trixie stepped over to them and stamped down hard. You bitch, Pendergrass said. Jackson and Cindy helped one another up, both wearing their own blood thanks to the trench coat. No one noticed him slip the broken glass into his coat. I'm going to count to three, and then I'm going to pull this trigger, Carla warned. Jackson headed past the trench coat. Jackson, where are you going? Cindy said. I'm going to clean up in the bathroom, he said. One. Scott Pendergrass dropped his hands and headed for the door, but stopped at the threshold before he made his exit. You'll be hearing from my lawyer. Two. He took his cue and exited the establishment. Jackson? Cindy called from the men's restroom doorway. There was no response. She entered the fluorescent-lit lavatory. Her eyes passed over the filthy floor where the toilet paper and discarded flyers littered the small space. Jackson, she said. No answer. The window above the lone stall was open.
Scott Pendergrass couldn't shake the feeling that he was being followed. He glanced over his shoulder, paranoid that the little piece of shit that had been tailing him earlier was back on the case. That was the problem with these little sidesteps into the smaller cities. The likelihood of running into a crazed fan or fucking jealous prick was much greater.
Damn you, Jenny. Why didn't you just place me in Portland?
He quickened his pace, and then he heard the scuffling of feet. He spun around. The street was deserted, as was the sidewalk that lined it. His heart rate accelerated, and his palms grew sweaty within the lined gloves. Snow, early even for Maine, began to drift down from the darkened sky.
"Who's there?"
he said. The scuffling came again. This time he heard it from his right, maybe from the little side street with no lights.
"If that's you..."
He tried to remember the stalker's name.
"Jackson, I'm really going to kick the shit out of you, and you won't have any of your whores to save you. You hear me?"
He saw a short silhouette step from the shadows and into the center of the road.
It was the little shit from the bookstore.
Scott Pendergrass's fear abated and was replaced by his desire to teach this putz a lesson. His eyes couldn't make out the guy's details. His sight was shit without his glasses. He stepped forward nonetheless. Something was sent flying toward him, skittering across the thin layer of snow already beginning to dress the ground. They were his broken frames. He leaned over and picked the expensive frames up.
"That's it, punk. Come here."
Jackson watched the trench coat foam at the mouth and stalk toward him. Jackson ignored the guy's threats and slipped the brass knuckles from the inside pocket of his jean jacket and over his hand. He waited, ready to pounce. Ready to make this guy pay for what he had just done to Cindy, for how he had just embarrassed him in front of his friends, and last, but not least, for writing things he knew nothing about.
"I don't know what your fucking problem is, but I have had just about enough of you," Pendergrass said, stepping up to the shorter man in the denim jacket.
Pendergrass reached into his trench coat and produced his personal protection. He aimed it at the ground and popped the switchblade open. "Now let's see how tough you are." Jackson's gaze fell upon the blade in the trench coat's hand and waited for the asshole to make the first move.
"Come on, tough guy," Trenchcoat said. "What, it wasn't enough for me to beat you down in front of all your high-class friends back there, huh? You want some more?"
Jackson held his tongue, but held his brass-dressed fist tucked neatly at his side. The trench coat jabbed at him once and again. Jackson leaned back out of the way both times. The guy was just trying to scare him. Jackson had something else in mind. This so-called zombie expert was going to become the student. Jackson hawked a loogie and spit it directly into Trenchcoat's eye. The Trenchcoat stumbled back a step and brought his free hand up to wipe the bright green mucus from his face.
"You filthy, vile son of a..." Jackson clenched his hand around the brass knuckles, stepped in close enough to smell the booze on the Trenchcoat's breath, and nailed him in the temple.
Pendergrass folded to the ground. The switchblade flew into the fine layer of white that now covered the ground. Jackson swung his legs over the moaning man. "I've got something to show you that's really going to blow your fucking mind." Before Pendergrass could reply, Jackson landed a second punch and rendered Pendergrass unconscious. It hadn't taken much for Jackson to get Cindy to lend him her car. She was all googly eyes for him. No one had ever tried to stand up for her the way he had. He promised to be back before the end of her shift. Jackson pulled the newer model Ford Focus up to the curb in front of the house he shared with his mother. He parked and hurried out. He jogged up the driveway and opened the garage door. His mother's beige 88 Plymouth Caravelle sat dormant. He snatched a roll of duct tape and a box cutter from the workspace beyond the car's hood before opening the car door. He slipped between the wheel and saw the keys were in the ignition just as he thought. He cranked the old car to life. He tried to only use the car when he had something to deliver. He backed out past Cindy's Focus, pulled the switch for the headlights, and headed to pick up his prize. He only hoped Pendergrass was still out cold. It had taken him nearly 20 minutes from when he left to get back to the dumpster he'd dragged Pendergrass to. He slipped the brass knuckles on, grabbed the duct tape, and climbed out of the car. In the shadows of the big green dumpster that sat beside the out-of-business Fido's Market, Scott Pendergrass lay slumped. A trail of dark blood congealed down the side of his face. Jackson slid the brass knuckles into his coat pocket and went to work, binding the man's wrists and ankles before he could come to his senses. Jackson saw another car pull up to the four-way a block down. He stood next to the Plymouth, hands stuffed in his pockets, and held his breath. The headlights veered away toward the more lively part of town. He exhaled and popped the trunk. He hurried back to Pendergrass, hefted the taller man up over his shoulder, and carried him to the trunk. He eased the unconscious man down and into the trunk as careful as he could.
There was a hunting knife in the glove box. If the trench coat woke up before they got home, he would have to use it on him. Jackson didn't want it to come to that, for he wanted him alive for his surprise. The snow had ceased as Jackson pulled his mother's car back into the garage. He stepped behind the car and rubbed his hands together before pulling the garage door closed. His fingers were numb against the metal handle. He should have taken the man's gloves. He moved around the car, unlocked the interior door, and propped it open with a kitchen chair. The warm air tried to entice him to stay. There was no time. Concussed or otherwise, Pendergrass could wake up at any moment. He needed to get him down into the basement. Jackson pulled out the box cutter, just in case, and opened the trunk. As the trunk lifted, Pendergrass's eyes fluttered open. He appeared disoriented. Jackson didn't want to kill him. He placed the box cutter between his teeth, grabbed Pendergrass's curled up legs, hauled them out of the trunk, and slipped off the man's shoes, each clonking on the concrete floor. Jackson wrapped his arms around the bottoms of Pendergrass's legs and slid his fingers along the man's nice dress socks. He found the ligament he was looking for. Pendergrass tried to struggle against him, but Jackson managed to hold his legs steady as he took the box cutter from his mouth, pushed the blade out with his thumb, and dragged it across one of Pendergrass's Achilles tendons, and then the other. Scott Pendergrass wasn't sure what had happened or where he was. There was someone standing over him. The person grabbed his legs and slipped his shoes off. Scott couldn't see too well, but as he felt someone with their back to him running their fingers up the back of his heel, he tried to move his legs. They moved as one. Were they tied? His mouth was taped. What in the hell was going on? He tried to collect his thoughts as they floated aimlessly behind his blurry vision. A brilliant white heat of pain exploded at the back of one foot and then the other. He tried to scream out. His legs were set free, but only flopped around as one useless unit. The man reached for him. Scott thrashed his head from side to side. Come on, Mr. New York Times bestseller. I have someone I really want you to meet. She might be your biggest fan. Scott tried to focus on the voice. He knew this man from somewhere. His thoughts were lost in a thick fog. He couldn't remember. The pain behind his heels was excruciating. He was sweating, and he felt nauseous. He didn't know where he was, and he couldn't remember how he got here or who this man was. A fan? A book signing? He was pulled from his surroundings. A car? A trunk? Oh, God. Oh, God. Jackson carried Pendergrass from the garage into the kitchen. Blood from the guy's wounds was going everywhere, but he could clean that up later. Right now, he had to get him down to his mother. He tried to balance Pendergrass on his shoulder while he undid the locks on the basement door. The guy was too heavy, and he was growing too tired. He shrugged Pendergrass off and let him hit the linoleum floor. He landed with a loud thump and lay still. Jackson checked to make sure he was still breathing, and he was. Probably just knocked the wind out of him. Good. Jackson got the last thick sliding lock open and then pulled out the key to the padlock at the top. He popped it free. He placed it on the kitchen counter next to the box cutter and the car keys. He opened the basement door. Chains rattled. Grunts and moans from his lovely mother echoed up from the darkness below. Jackson flicked the lights on and heard her groan. It wasn't the soft voice of the woman who had held him on stormy nights or that coddled him when they found out his dad died of a heart attack at the mill. It wasn't the silky tones of the woman who'd advised him on how to ask Becca Colby to the sixth grade dance or ask out Missy Nichols later that year. No, it was the hungry, violent growls of the thing his mother had become 3 weeks ago. Scott Pendergrass's mind snapped into focus. The sounds coming up from below raked his spine over icy mounds of terror. The voice was guttural, horrid. The man, the guy from the bookstore, the one who'd followed him. Jackson. Jackson grinned at him and clasped hold of his wounded legs. Scott thrashed and bucked as he began to slide across the floor and toward that awful sound. Behind the tape over his mouth, he screamed. He screamed for all he was worth, but barely registered the sound over the ones coming from below. His back scraped against the threshold and then on the top step. His head smacked on each step on the way down before thwacking on the concrete floor. The world spun sideways again, but he begrudgingly retained consciousness. His blurred vision landed upon the thing in chains. This was the thing responsible for the horrible groans and grunts. Chains rattled. Its shuffling feet scuffed the floor as he was dragged closer and closer. Jackson hated the smell down here. His mother's gradual decomposition coated the large basement with the funk of decay. His eyes landed upon the scuffed Chuck Taylors and the shredded Perry the Platypus t-shirt lying in a pile next to the box of old romance novels. He covered his nose and mouth with the front of his t-shirt, his guts sinking, and stepped over the Goodman boy's tattered rags.
"This is the guy that writes those books I was telling you about. The ones about, well, you know, what you've become."
Jackson gazed down at Pendergrass. The damn fool was trying to roll away. He would have to fix this. He glanced along the edge of the room. In the shadows cast by the dim light overhead, he spotted the black frame of his old freestyle bike. Beneath it were his old tools of the trade, an adjustable wrench and a screwdriver. He hunched over, picked up the Phillips, and bent down next to Pendergrass.
"I can't have you rolling out of her reach. She's been starving down here. Look at her. She really wants to meet you."
Jackson flipped the handle and held the screwdriver face down. He lifted one of Pendergrass's arms and slammed the tool down into his ribs. He did it again and again, rolled him onto his back and jabbed him once more in the guts. He threw the implement to the wall across the room.
"Okay, Mr. New York Times bestseller, it's time for you and my mom to get acquainted. You may find this hard to believe, but she knows a hell of a lot more about being a zombie than you do."
Jackson shoved the man over until his mother's dead hands latched onto him. "Good night, Mom." Jackson climbed the stairs, singing a tune to himself. He didn't like listening to the sound of people being chewed on. Zombies were not his cup of tea. The next day, at high noon, Jackson Benoit entered the crowded little bookstore of his friend, Bert. Bert's boyfriend, Mark, stood behind the counter. They were awaiting the arrival of the New York Times best-selling author of Zombie University. Jackson grinned at the two men and scooted past the crowd of people with bad taste in books. He saw the baffled look cross Bert's features. Making his way to the back of the crowd, Jackson pulled his black-gloved hands from the pockets of his newly acquired trench coat and waited. He couldn't stop smiling. This was the best book signing he had ever been to. Candle magic. Why do I light a candle when I sit down to write? It's a ritual of transportation. The place I need to go waits for me. I disappear into the pirouetting swirl of orange and yellow burning within the glass jar. A source of magic contained, taking me from one place to the next. An enchanting evening walk crackles with the smell of moonlight over a murderous canvas of surf and sea. Its perfume is a swaying body of deeper meaning I am compelled to discover. I ascend my perch on the shore, pulled under the spell of the swell delivered in the night. My fingers tap dance. The story bleeds onto the screen as my eyes are open in two worlds that could not be farther apart. My family, slumbering in their beds. The characters, in a violating sea of incredible peril. The candle, a doorway between the two. The astral plane patiently observes me stumbling through its world of juxtapositions. The untamed beast gorging itself at the expense of an innocent bystander. While just beyond the gruesome display of blood and power, a young couple plays back and forth with the electricity. For those two souls in that exact space and time, violent death and first love laid out for my evening's work. I wander on, following a path I'd like to claim ownership of, but knowing that is not possible. I am a vessel adrift in a land open to those who seek its marvels. I simply and graciously accept the tour, acting as a medium, transcribing what I am shown. A playground of creepy crawlies, things that are the bumps in the night. Mysterious, yet courageous, protagonists coalesce in the whirlpool of unparalleled exhilaration as I get lost in the poetry of happenings. A wave rises, stretching to the clouds. Its massive shadow envelops me, a black speck among the thrashing blue world. I am helpless as the wall of this inspired sea comes crashing down. I am thrown and pulled under, my equilibrium a distant memory. I am captive to its will. I make my return from that world to this one, my eyes bloodshot from staring, my soul tired from the journey. Time has slipped by at an impossible pace, performing with stealth and grace. I am deposited to the sands of reality crashing on the beach, ready to go home. I put away my photographic words, grasp the glass jar of magic. My fingers scream at the immense heat birthed from the spring of power within. I blow out the flame and watch its ghosts swirl up into the air, set to return tomorrow night. Flaws. We're flawed. Human beings. It's what sets us apart above and beyond the other species on this planet, and what scars us most. It's also what separates us from the light and the innocent. Free will. Thought. That precious and devious flame that burns so bright in our neuropathways. And what of that nasty little trigger we feed along the way? Impulse. For as much of a role human nature plays in the creation of our humanity, sometimes it's equally guilty in our lack thereof. Often, we become victims of circumstance, influenced in our lives by hurt and pain, compelled to do wicked things. I know now it's what made me do the things I did. That's what I told the detective when he had a second chance to question me. Let's go back to the start. It was September, the time when summer in Maine clings to its last warm days before the cold comes creeping home. I was the librarian at Godsville Elementary School. Was. I held the position for 7 years before my flaws stood up and forced their way through. Through the light, through the days, through the mundane day-to-day life I had lived, they were always with me. That's what I told Detective Brenner, too. But we'll get to that. The children came in, they went out. All of their teachers and ed techs ushered them back and forth. The first week was like all the rest. I smiled, led them to the books they looked for, helped set up snacks and story times. It was at the end of that first week when something wicked forced its way into the front of my mind. My cat, Jinky, welcomed me home as she always did. Mewling, she rubbed her long, gray, fur-covered body against my leg. Only that day, it failed to make me smile. I saw what she was doing for what it was. Begging. Manipulating. I knelt down and let her rub against my arm. Hungry, Jinky? Well, guess what? I can take care of that. Would you like that, huh? I stroked Jinky's head before tucking my thumb and forefinger behind her ears and clenching her neck. She tensed beneath my fingers and revolted. I let go of my humanity and snapped her neck. She went limp, soulless, in my grip. Freed from the trappings someone dressed as morality, I came alive for the first time in years. I rose with the dead cat in my hand, carried her to the kitchen counter, and dropped her carcass on top of yesterday's bills. From my fridge, I pulled out a bottle of red wine and poured myself a glass. I swallowed it down and followed it with another. My attention returned to Jinky. I'm sure guilt stirred somewhere within me, though I don't recall its presence, but surely it was around. She had made me smile every day and brought companionship to my life. How could I not feel remorse? I scooped up the body, walked to the maroon trash can in the corner next to the microwave, depressed the lever at its base, and discarded of Jinky with the rest of the refuse of the last 2 days. That night, I remember lying awake, my hands tucked behind my graying black hair, considering what my next day of new life would bring. The anticipation kept me alert and smiling until sometime after 2 a.m. Saturday morning, I went for a jog. Along the Hines Road, I kept my eyes peeled for anything that I could observe and snuff out. Melinda Williamson, the hot-bodied brunette who lived in the little two-bedroom house next door to me, waved and said hello as she jogged in the opposite direction. My mouth went dry. My throat constricted. I waved at her with a sweaty palm in a weak, limp-wristed motion. I wanted to fuck her. I'd only had sex with two girls my entire life, and those were two very forgettable experiences. Still, I had a clue what I was missing. I made a mental note and continued my search for something to destroy. I'd made it all the way around the block, but not a single critter showed its beady eyes along my running route. A few hundred feet from my house, a little brownish toad hopped out from the dewy weeds off the shoulder of the street and into my path. The dark smile slowly spread across my face. I altered my path and brought my size 8 Nike down upon the amphibian. The squishy, splatter noise, followed by the guts and goo that squirted out from under my running shoe, warmed my human heart. Another blast of exhilaration coursed through my body. I jogged up the steps to my house, feeling like I'd just had the best run of my life. Once inside, I considered going back for the little mangled body, but decided it would not be worth the time to scrape it up. I sat down with the leftover half of a Subway BLT left in my fridge and watched a classic Cary Grant film on Turner Classic Movies. Sunday morning, I attended service at Hope and Faith Baptist Community Church. I fell asleep to Pastor Luke's booming sermon. I'd been up all night again, anxious about today's opportunities. Edith Heath elbowed me awake. "Dennis, is God's word not lively enough for you this morning?" I sat up, stretched my arms out to the side, and said, "I'm more alive than I've been in years, Mrs. Heath." "Well, you sure have a funny way of showing it. Maybe next time Pastor Luke's delivering the Lord's word, you'll show a little more respect." I blocked her way as she tried to pass. Maybe I don't need Pastor Luke or the Lord's word to lead a full life. "Dennis, I beg your pardon. I'm not sure what's gotten into you today, but I'd appreciate it if you'd let me pass." I imagined reaching out and wrapping my hands around her loose-skinned throat and giving her the Jinky treatment. How good would that feel? While I was daydreaming,
Edith pushed past me. I watched her waddle away. She dared a couple of glances back at me. There was fear in her eyes. I contemplated following her home, but lost interest in the old lady once Melinda Williamson started down the aisle, outfitted in a flowing sea green dress, her dark hair up in a bun atop her head. Her brown eyes caught mine. "Morning, Mr. Greeley."
"Morning, Melinda."
She continued on and disappeared into the crowd surrounding the community bulletin board by the front door. I broke out of the haze her presence had created and made my way out of the door. From the front steps of the church, I looked for her and the breezy Sunday dress. She was already gone. At home, I kept seeing that dress and those tanned, firm legs pegging out from the hem. I had my hand in my pants and worked myself into a tizzy of lustful images, stroking my member until I finished off in my underwear. The release felt more vacant than usual. There was never a great moment of fulfillment from masturbating, but now, after these last couple of days, this tug was especially hollow. I knew, if I dared, I could bring this part of my life to glory as well. I just had to let go. At dusk, I needed more. The toad in the road paled in comparison to Janky. Onward and upward to something bigger. I waited outside my back door. Missy's whine called to me. Melinda always left the husky in the backyard tethered to her runner while she went to do her evening workout at the 24-hour gym downtown. I had about an hour to accomplish what I had planned. I gave Melinda an extra 10 minutes to make sure she wouldn't be coming back for something she may have forgot. Dusk welcomed the night. September's cold whisper left a chill in the evening. I zipped up my gray Patriots hoodie, donned my black winter gloves, drew the large kitchen knife from my belt, and stalked across my yard and into Melinda's. Missy lay still, her head perched upon her paws, watching me with her bright blue eyes. She was a good bitch. She never barked, never nipped, and never lunged at passerby like some dogs in the neighborhood. No, this beautiful white, gray, black, furred dog was a good dog. I wanted to do this quick. She deserved a fast release. "Missy! Here, Missy!" I approached her slow and steady, hand out for her to smell. Her head did not move. She just raised her doggy brow and eyed me. "Come on, girl. Come on." I fluttered the fingers of my left hand toward her. She got up and started toward me. "Aw, what a good girl," I said. I went down on bended knee and put my left arm around her and scratched her under her chin with my fingernails. She raised her head to fully accept the scratch. I worked my hand up to her chin and then yanked it upward while I simultaneously pressed the razor-sharp blade against her throat and dragged it across her neck. She struggled against me as the blood flowed from her neck. She moved from a growl to a whine and back and forth a few times before her fight soon abandoned her. I stayed with her until her soul followed her spirit. I wasn't sure what to do with her empty shell. I hadn't thought past the act. Melinda would be home soon. I checked my watch. 7:27. I had 10 minutes, maybe, if she didn't stop off somewhere after the gym. I wiped the blade of the knife off, smearing it on the dead creature's fur. The crunch of tires on gravel stole my breath. Two burning gold beams of light crashed against the side of my house. Melinda was home early. Panic engulfed my good vibrations and paralyzed me. I went on autopilot. Before I knew what I was doing, I had the carcass cradled in my arms. I moved, silent and swift, to the overgrown weeds and bushes at the edge of the freshly mowed lawn and heaved the dead thing into the green depths. I ran to my back door and ducked inside just as Melinda called out. "Missy! Here, girl! Missy! Missy!" I placed my ear to the slightly opened door. The sound of her confusion thrilled me. On the other hand, the thought of her coming to my door and asking me if I'd seen the dog filled me with an anxiousness I was ill-prepared for. Her scream hit my excitement like a wet blanket. I eased the door closed. I moved to the kitchen and threw the blade in the trash along with the bloody sweatshirt, gloves, and sweatpants. I rushed to my bathroom to clean any signs of blood from my exposed skin, careful not to turn on any lights. I used the moonlight peering through the window to wipe away the dark lines of blood from under my chin. Satisfied, I climbed in my bed, folded my hands over my chest, and closed my eyes. Safe and sound in my bed, the smile returned. The pounding on my door lasted for about 10 minutes. Melinda. I gripped my blankets and pulled them tight to my body. When she left, I relaxed. An hour later, the booms began again. My heart stuttered. Without looking, I knew who it was. I slipped from my bed and glided down the hall and into the bathroom. This time, I flipped the light on.
A dried, dark line was caked from the top of my right cheek to my low-hanging earlobe. I turned on the water and scrubbed the evidence away. The pounding continued. I double-checked, then triple-checked for blood and found none. I shut the light and moved to the living room door. Two officers, one big and one small, who brought Dr. Seuss's Fred and Ted to mind, nearly made me laugh as I saw them standing on my steps.
"Evening, sir. Sorry to wake you,"
the little one, Fred, said.
"What is it, officers? Has something happened?"
"I'm afraid so. Have you been home all evening?"
"Yes, I've been home since church."
Ted spoke up. "Did you happen to hear any disturbances from next door?"
"My God, is Melinda all right?"
"Yes, Ms. Williams is okay. Did you hear her dog stir up at all in the time you've been home?"
"No. Has something happened to..."
I pretended to not know the dog's name.
"Oh, that's such a beautiful dog."
"Unfortunately, we have reason to believe someone killed the animal," Fred said.
"What? Who on God's earth would harm that precious creature?"
"We're trying to figure that out, sir. Is there anything you can recall that maybe seemed out of place? A noise, perhaps? Excessive barking or whining?"
"No, I'm sorry. I watched a few westerns this afternoon and went to bed early. I can't say I noticed anything."
I couldn't read their expressions. Police always looked so serious.
Always looked so suspicious.
"Well," Ted said, "if you do remember anything at all that you think might help us out, can you call it into the station?"
"Certainly, officer."
I closed the door and watched them from behind my Venetian blinds as they crossed the front lawn to Melinda's. Little Fred looked back. I let the blind drop. Monday morning, back behind my oak desk, I spaced out while the children scurried in and out of aisles of books like ants. Only, ants always seemed to have direction. The children were aimless. I was remembering last night's kill when one of the small people broke me from my reverie.
"Mr. Greeley?"
"Yes, Michael?" Michael Wilkes was the runt of the litter. Pasty skin, festooned with freckles, a long, pointy nose, a crooked bottom tooth that I'd heard some of the meaner boys refer to as his snaggletooth, and a mop of ratty strawberry blonde hair that hung over all of his features like a canopy of straw. Looking into his watery blue eyes, I knew my next opportunity had revealed itself.
"Yes, Michael, what is it?"
"Some of the kids were pushing me. I was wondering..."
"I'll take care of them this time, Michael. But from here on out, you're on your own. Eventually, a man's got to stand up for himself, okay?"
"Mm-hmm."
Ralph Vanderveld and Connor Higgy bolted out through the door to the hallway. Chicken shit bullies. I'd had my share of them in grade school as well. They would probably continue to pick on and beat down poor Michael well into high school. He'd asked for my help. I would oblige. I walked back to where the boy waited by my desk and glanced at the clock on the wall.
"Michael, I was teased as a kid, too."
"You were?"
"Yeah."
"What did you do?"
"I can't tell you here, but I'll tell you what. Why don't you meet me by the swings after lunch?"
"But I've got gym after lunch."
"That's okay. I can get you a pass. This one time." He nodded. "Do you want to be able to stand up to those meanies like me?" The boy smiled. He did, in fact, have a snaggletooth. "Okay, then. Meet me by the swings, the ones closest to the teacher's parking lot. Can you do that?"
"Right after lunch?"
"Yes."
"Okay, it's a deal."
Michael stuck out his hand. I shook it. It was clammy. Poor kid. I tried my best to keep busy and not think about my date with the boy. 2 hours felt like a millennia. Finally, the lunch bell rang. I enjoyed my chicken salad sandwich on the curb between the cafeteria's back door and the faculty lot. I had a perfect and clear view of the swing set. I got up and stepped back by the janitor's paint-peeled woodshed, and I watched the swarm of kids swirl and then vacate the lunchroom. Michael popped his raggedy head out through the side door farther down. I waved. He came running.
"Where are we going?"
"To my car. That's where I keep my journal."
"Oh."
I glanced around the lot. No one else was around. I guided Michael before me into my Toyota Corolla.
"Where is it?"
"It's right..." I clenched my fingers in the boy's rat's nest and slammed him face first into the side of the vehicle. He collapsed in a heap at my feet. I checked my surroundings once more, scooped up his delicate little body, and dumped him into the back seat. I had to bite my lip to contain my excitement. I also had to get the boy back to my house and get back to the library before the entire place went into lockdown. I wasted no time. My house was only 5 minutes from the school. I pulled up to my driveway and drove up onto the lawn and around to the back. I hesitated just a moment as I glanced at Missy's empty doghouse. I snapped from the recall of the other night and rushed the boy inside. He was still breathing. I would fix that, but not now. There was no time. I wrapped the boy's wrists
ankles, and mouth with duct tape and put him in my bedroom closet. I was back in the school parking lot as recess was ending. I returned to my parking space and slithered in through the cafeteria door right by the lunch lady, Kira Little. She was having her secret smoke, a true no-no on school grounds, but I wouldn't tell. And she would forget that she held the door for me. Within 10 minutes, the freakout was on. Every member of the faculty helped scour the school inside and out. I volunteered to help skirt the outside of the grounds. Shouting his name only made me want to rush home. The children were sent home early. I was back with little Michael by 3 o'clock. I opened the closet door. His rosy cheeks were covered in tears. "Shh, shh, Michael. I'm going to help you like we agreed." I lifted the timid thing from the floor and carried him into the bathroom. I eased him down into the bathtub. "You remember our friends, Ralph Vanderveld and Connor Hickey?" He nodded. "They love to pick on boys like you. Boys like I used to be. It makes them feel big. They feel tough, manly. Do you think that makes them manly?" Michael didn't respond this time. Instead, fresh tears rained from his blue eyes. I ruffled his hair even as he tried to cower from my touch. I pulled back and held my hands with palms up in surrender. "Okay, okay. Let's get you that help I promised, yes?" I didn't stay for his reaction, but heard the whimpering and whining as I went back into the kitchen. I knew his pain. I knew his torment. Boys like Ralph and Connor were a festering disease that fed off the lack of discipline in modern public schools. I picked the second largest knife from the block on my kitchen counter, as the largest had been collected this morning by the garbage man. Michael's tear-streaked face was the result of pure ugliness. I couldn't help but see my own young face, the weakness, the fear. Not quite handsome, but too far off to attract random acts of kindness. A rage suddenly bubbled under my skin. Before I could dissect it and return to the euphoric space of the last couple of days, I charged at the boy, dropped to my knees, and began to stab. It was nightfall by the time I could accept what I'd done to Michael. I had set him free from a future that would only have devoured him over time. The endorphins kicked in. My wave of freedom. I cleaned myself up in the sink, brushed my teeth, and went to bed. My alarm clock went off at 2 a.m. Under the night sky, the stars shone brighter than I ever remembered, and it was beautiful. I pulled the shovel from beneath my back porch steps and dug a hole for Michael's empty shell. It was past 5 o'clock in the morning by the time I had everything bleached and tidied up. I was about to try and catch a few more minutes of sleep when I heard a door shut. I hurried to the living room window and peeked out through the blinds. I was just in time to grab a glimpse of Melinda Williamson's tight ass as she jogged around the corner of her yard. Impulse cinched my chest, tight and desperate. The call was too much to resist. I threw on my sweats and raced out into the early morning air. I had her in my sights within 5 minutes. I grew dizzy in her presence as I watched her ponytail jostle back and forth against the bright blue sweatshirt. I wanted to snatch her by it and pull her to me. A car passed, the first of the otherwise desolate early morning. She hadn't noticed me as far as I could tell. I scanned the sides of the road for a spot to make my move. Just past Harmon Street, a short field opened to an old walking path leading down to the river. I made my charge. Melinda's head swiveled just before I wrapped my arms around her. The earbuds fell over my forearms. She was much stronger than I thought, her muscles tensed beneath my own. She nearly broke free. I tightened my hold and spun us to the cold concrete sidewalk. Her head smacked to the ground. Her fight fled. I glanced for traffic. The road remained empty. It was difficult for me, but I got her slung over my shoulder and crossed the road. She stirred and began to slip from my grasp. "Help!" I dropped her to the ground, then sat atop of her with my knees on her right arm and chest. I punched at her determined face, only to have her block my shot with her free arm. "Help!" "Shut up! Shut up!" I swung at her with both fists, one after another. She blocked a couple more shots, but I plowed ahead. I caught her in the mouth and yanked my hand back. My knuckle spilled blood from where I connected with the tooth now missing from her gorgeous smile. This was all wrong. It wasn't meant to be like this. A car door shut somewhere behind us. "Hey!" A man's voice barked from the road. I hadn't been able to get Melinda out of sight. The mouth of the trail lay just beyond us. I had this nosy bastard coming for me, and though Melinda was moaning and dazed, she could spring at me again any moment. I should have grabbed another knife, another weapon, something. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I could see Melinda's fluttering eyes return from the stars. She stared into me. I knew I had to do it. I had to release her soul. I needed to do it now before it was too late. I pinned her pestering left arm beneath my other and held her chin steady.
I imagined her nose smashing through her brain, the sparks in her mind exploding, the exhilaration in my soul sprouting wings and chasing hers toward the great beyond. I was hit by the Mack truck of a man who'd stopped to play the hero. My face slammed into the dirt. Something snapped in my left shoulder as I was crushed beneath the man's weight. My other arm was violently placed behind my back. I cried out. The weakness I'd absolved myself of returned in a whirlwind of failure. "Miss," the hero said. "Miss, can you hear me? Are you all right?"
Yes, thank you.
"Take the phone from my coat pocket. Dial 911. Officer Fred arrived to cuff me. Ted was nowhere to be seen. I was hauled down to the station and thrown into a room with only a table and two chairs. Hollow. That's how the room felt. The end. That's what it was. Officer Fred shoved me down into the uncomfortable wooden chair. He exited the room and left me to wait. Detective Brenner, a sharp-looking young man in a blue suit and dark tie, took the chair opposite me and folded his hands atop the flat, lifeless table. "Mr. Greeley, we have a team searching your house. Do you have anything you want to tell me?" I thought of Jinky. I thought of the toad. I thought of Missy and Michael. "No?" Detective Brenner said. I thought of Melinda.
If only...
"We can sit here all day. They'll find him." I looked up. Detective Brenner had his red hair high and tight. I figured he'd been a military man at some point in his young life. His hazel eyes held mine. He was one cool character, but he had his flaws too. "Did you ever kill anybody over there?" I said. "Excuse me? You're ex-military, right? You ever kill a sand nigger? Or maybe one of those threatening little kamikaze children?" He squinted, a hint of crow's feet around the corner of his eyes. "We have reason to suspect you abducted Michael Conrad yesterday afternoon. We also believe you're responsible for the disappearance of Ms. Williamson's dog."
"You did," I said.
I straightened up in the chair and leaned closer, my nose a foot from his.
"You murdered them.
Slaughtered them." I shook my head and grinned. "You beat me to it."
"What's that, Mr. Greeley?
What did I beat you to?" My cheeks started to get sore. I was smiling so hard. I couldn't help it. I could see his scars, his filthy humanity.
"Are you going to fill me in or just keep grinning like an idiot?"
"Your hands are just as dirty as mine. You're just a liar." I spit in his face and grinned with my tongue peeking out between my front teeth. His nostrils flared, his face went tight, his teeth bared. His flaws were on full display. His chair smacked the wall behind him with a loud crack. I followed him as he rose up. I watched his fist plummet toward my face. I felt his knuckles crash into my mouth and the tip of my tongue explode with a searing pain. My head hit the concrete floor with a sick thwack. The door to the dead room swung open. There was shouting from Detective Brenner and from the two officers that entered. In my swimming head, I heard bits of what was being said. They found blood, freshly dug ground, dog carcass in the bushes. I thought if only I could have had more time. But even in our imperfections, we are flawed. My eyes rolled as the room fell to black. Halloween worm.
"Eat shit, Keith."
I picked up my little sister's Barney pillowcase and scavenged as much candy as I could see in the darkened dirt lot beneath my feet. Frankie had insisted on not cutting through the field, but I knew it would get us back to my house in time to catch AMC's annual showing of Halloween. The field skirted Paul's pick-apart, a sort of vehicular organ donor center two roads over from mine. Frankie had warned me about it being so close to Holt Street and its number one bad boy, Keith Dennis. But I let my love for Michael Myers override the undercurrent of dread that flowed at the dumb ox's name, and now, here we all are. Keith Dennis was a bully in the purest sense, ugly as a dog gone mad from rabies. His face, with its too wide nose, fat lips that clung like leeches to his mouth, and a bad acne scar that flared on his left cheek like some horrible explosion in the cosmos, looked pure mean. The guy had a natural-born instinct to single out kids half his size, throw some dumb insults about how their friends are their butt buddies, and a rotten gift that allowed him to take and break the amazing glow sword that you busted your butt making from pure ingenuity, something guys like Keith Dennis couldn't spell, let alone appreciate, just because he's an asshole.
"What'd you say, you little shit?"
Keith said. He held the broken handle of my sword, dropped his own bag of candy, and stepped forward. My guts turned. My voice of reason whimpered. "I told you so." But as my eyes landed upon the now non-glowing plastic blade lying in the dirt behind this jerk, the part of my genetic makeup that got me in trouble with guys like Keith Dennis did the unthinkable.
Next to one of the bite-sized Snickers bars that had escaped my candy sack, there was a smooth, oval rock the size of my fist. Before I had time to consider the consequences, I snatched the mini boulder, jumped to my feet, and cracked Keith across the temple with it. He stumbled backward, dropped the handle of my broken sword, and held his head. A thin trickle of dark liquid seeped through his fingers. I looked over at Frankie, whose eyes were as big and bright as the full moon over our heads, and said, "Run!" The blood gushing from Keith's head as he pulled his giant mitt away from the wound birthed an outright sense of oh-shit panic and spurred my need to escape. The fluorescent light I'd carefully placed inside the plastic blade of my sword crunched beneath my sneakers. I grabbed Frankie by his $10 Dracula cape and made for the dull lights of Holt Street.
Dan, shouldn't we tell somebody to, I don't know, help him?
Frankie's voice never sounded so whiny. We hit the pavement, our sneakers slapping as we moved toward the first house, Mrs. Bean's.
"Just shut up, Frankie," I said. "You want me to get in trouble?"
"No, but..."
Headlights cut the darkness as blue lights swirled to life. "Oh, shit. Oh, shit."
"Is that Dan Trask and Frankie Taylor?"
"Officer Gilchrist.
Grade A hardass and all-around fuckhole." He stepped out of the car, lights still whirling through the night, and walked our way as we stopped and tried to catch our breath. "Where are you boys coming from tonight?"
Think.
"They were with me. I fell back there by the lot, and they were running to get help. It was Keith, but he didn't look right."
"Ain't that right, guys?"
he said. Keith stepped up to my side and placed one of his bear-like arms around my shoulders. Frankie would have looked pale as the undead even without the makeup.
Yeah, we thought he was hurt,"
I managed. I felt Keith's thick fingers press into my arms.
"Want to tell me what you boys were doing down by Paul Meekham's scrapyard?"
"Just kid stuff, throwing rocks at the old beaters," Keith said. "One bounced right back and hit me in the head. I got a little queasy when I saw the blood, but I'm okay."
"I could bring you boys in tonight for throwing rocks down there,"
Officer Gilchrist said. He could, but he wouldn't.
"I know, officer, but we didn't break anything, honest. We just want to finish trick-or-treating and get home for some scary movies.
Please don't tell my dad," I said. I knew I sounded like a little wussy boy, but Keith's story was better than mine. Besides, there was shame in being driven home in a cop car. But dealing with Keith Dennis, well, that was just a matter of manning up and taking what you got coming.
"All right, but if I catch you boys back down here tonight, you're all going in."
"Yes, sir," Keith and I said in unison. I could see a grin. A "just you wait" grin dance onto his ugly face. The big lug kept me muckled to his side as we watched Officer Gilchrist drive away.
"Hey, Frankie," Keith said.
Poor Frankie looked over with eyes that begged not to be hurt.
"Yeah? Get the fuck out of here. Me and your boyfriend got some man-to-man business to deal with."
Frankie's eyes met mine, and I nodded. He didn't deserve the beatdown. I did. The empathy in his pleading eyes was good enough for me. Keith and I stood like best buds. Butt buddies, as he would say. I watched Frankie skulk down the sidewalk, his small shadow bouncing along after him beneath the street lamps. The lump in my throat threatened to choke me. Before I had a chance to try and talk my way out of the maximum pain sentence Keith Dennis loved to dole out to his victims, his McGregor swept my feet from under me as he yanked the hood of my sweatshirt backward. I slammed onto the sidewalk, the wind from my lungs released faster than a rocket pass from Peyton Manning.
"I got something special for you, Trask," he said.
He dropped one fat knee atop my chest and fished around in his Halloween sack. He pulled out an orange prescription bottle. He uncapped it and wiggled something into his hand. My eyes landed on the thing that squirmed between his fingers. A worm.
"This was in my candy apple from Mr. Danson's house. You know that crazy old fuck on Emerson Road? He denies it, but my Uncle Jerry told me that fucker's a sex offender, a child rapist. I ain't scared of no pederast. So I knocked on his door last year. He gave me a candy apple. The sick bastard grinned like he wanted to suck my stump right then and there."
I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, and I never prayed so hard to see Officer Gilchrist in my whole life.
I took that candy apple, opened it as I was walking down his shitty cat-infested porch steps, and ate it on my way to the next house. I never looked back, but I could feel his creepy boy fucking eyes on the back of my head.
Keith looked like he was in the middle of a dream. I could see his eyes glisten in the streetlights as he looked at the streets behind us.
"You see this fucking hole in my cheek?" he said,
a more natural hatred fixed in his eyes. I did see the mark on his face, the one I thought was a bad acne scar.
"My ma took me to the emergency room that night.
He paused. A tear slipped from the corner of his right eye. He sucked in two quick breaths through his wide nose, trying to hide a hitch. I could feel something tearing at the inside of my mouth, all right. I was trying to enjoy Terror Train, but this thing kept chewing at me. I thought it was some kind of bad canker. I tried to lay down and go to sleep, and I dozed right off with the screams coming from the TV. I opened my eyes an hour later, reached for my face, and felt the blood. And then the hole. I didn't bother looking at it. I just ran to my ma's room and pulled her out of bed. She got us down to the ER, where they got me right in. He stopped and stared at the thing between his fingers. It wiggled hello. This is what the doc pulled out of my mouth that night, except it wasn't moving. He told me it was dead. I asked him if I could have it. I was going to torture it, dead or not. But after they patched up my face and I got home, it began to move. I wanted to crush it up, spill its guts, but I had a thought. I was going to get that fucking pervert. I knew it was him. Captivated by his story, I couldn't remember my own fear. His cheek was still discolored, but you couldn't tell it had ever had a hole in it. He grabbed me by the front of my sweatshirt with his free hand. My fear returned in spades. Oh, God, don't let him make me eat that thing. Stop acting like a queer, he said. He dropped the worm back into the little orange pill bottle and capped it. That old man's getting his payback, and you're going to help me. What? Why me? He let go of my sweatshirt and stood back up. Because I ain't got nobody else. I ain't got no real friends. And you owe me for hitting me with that goddamn rock. He had me there. So we're doing this now? I said. Fucking right we are. We set out. Neither of us said another word until we reached Emerson Road. Mr. Danson's house and its cat-littered porch sat in complete darkness. By way of bad omen, the street lamp next to his pervert shack went out. We both looked up. Fuck it, Keith said. Come on, he's getting his little friend back whether he wants it or not. I followed. Our candy sacks had been left behind. Keith carried the little prescription bottle with the odd cheek-eating worm in his hand as he led the way around the abandoned house next to Danson's and into the old man's backyard. The night seemed dead. No cars, no children, and no wind. The hair stiffened on the back of my neck. I wondered if Mr. Danson was waiting for us. Hold this, Keith said. He handed me the bottle with the awful Halloween worm. I tried to protest, but he grunted and glared at me. I took the little orange bottle with the white label. I'm going to walk around the front and knock on his door. What? I said, louder than I meant to. Shh. He's going to open up just like last year, and I'm going to slam his ass to the ground. Once I rough him up a little, I'm going to let you in the back. Then we'll give him what's his. It was a shit plan. A damn shitty plan. But he was up and off before I could say so. I listened, hearing his footsteps around the house, crunching leaves the old man hadn't cared to rake from under the tree hanging over the corner of his house like some sort of giant spider. After a few seconds, I heard Keith knock. This is stupid. This is really, really stupid. I should just drop this creepy thing and go home. You son of a bitch! I heard Mr. Danson's high-pitched voice yell. There was a scuffle. I could hear feet shuffling, a door banging, and various grunts and curse words from both of them. And then the door slammed shut. Who won? Run! The good voice of reason screamed at me. Instead, I waited. The silence wasn't golden, but it was more like pure hell on a stick, dripping red with the blood of innocence gone wrong. Still, we waited. Just me and the evil Halloween worm. What a pair. The latch on the back door rattled and intruded on my thoughts. My body hair reached for the radio airwaves above. I held my breath. The back door swung open. Come on, man, Keith said. He was breathing heavy. A small burst of fireworks set off over my elated fears. A small victory. I knocked that geriatric pervert out with his own cane, he said as I slipped into the dark hallway behind him. He managed to whack me in the same spot you did, but all it did was piss me off. I jumped him, pinned him to the ground, and threw a couple solid punches into his old man face. Once I beat the fight out of him, I took his cane and whacked him good over the head with it. Jesus, I thought. Lucky if he didn't kill him. I prayed that the guy, pervert or not, was still alive. Sure enough, there he lay sprawled out on a matted forest green rug. He had a giant red mark on his forehead. Two of his dozen cats, one white, one black, sat mewling by his head as if to stir him awake. The living room of his home smelled like cat piss and shit mixed with cigarettes and hamburger grease. At least six other cats strutted around and licked themselves, indifferent to the two newcomers standing in the room. The little brown couch against the wall opposite the front door was torn to shit.
Stuffing spilled out of it like the guts of Braveheart. I looked around and saw a wooden baseball bat leaning against a metal rack between the door and small TV stand. Atop the metal rack was a fish tank. It was filled with dirt instead of water. Ant farm? More likely a worm farm. An evil, cheek-eating worm farm.
Okay, give me the worm, Keith said.
Gladly.
All right, you fucking pederast bastard. Time to take your medicine, he said.
Keith popped off the white cap, squeezed the old man's cheeks, and opened his toothless mouth. Mr. Danson looked like a dying fish. Keith jiggled the orange bottle directly over the open O. I watched the worm drop in and disappear. Mr. Danson jerked and gagged. Keith clamped his hands over the old man's maw.
What are you doing?
I said. Mr. Danson's eyes shot open. He squirmed and writhed behind Keith's hand, gagging all the while.
Shut up, Trask! Keith barked.
He turned back to Mr. Danson.
How do you like it, you fucking perv?
Mr. Danson's eyes were wild. He brought his right hand up to Keith's face. I couldn't do anything but watch as the old man drove his thumb through Keith's left eye. Keith screamed, devoured the silence. He flailed at Mr. Danson. Keith's arms looked like one of those crazy Daisy lawn toys that shook every which way. Mr. Danson's thumb jabbed over and over into Keith's ruined eye. The sick man's gaze sparkled with madness. He was delirious with a wicked joy.
I should stop this. I should kick him in the head, or smash him in the face with something.
I stumbled backward, plopping down on the gut-spewing couch, playing witness to this horror. Keith, reaching for his eye, fell off the crazy old man. Mr. Danson stood. My eyes caught the tinting in the front of his sweatpants. Keith rolled back and forth on the carpet and held both hands over the latest damage inflicted by this strange man.
You boys should have stayed home tonight, Mr. Danson said. Hold still, you crybaby faggot, he said.
He placed his boot on Keith's ankle and leaned forward.
I said, hold still, faggot.
Keith's pain cut deep into my heart. Mr. Danson moved up to Keith's head, stepping on various parts of the bully on the floor along the way. He turned his devil eyes to me.
This the kind of company you keep, boy?
I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. He stood over Keith and looked down upon him with disgust.
I should pull out your dirty little thingy and give it a good tug. Would you like that, huh?
He said, pushing the toe of his boot down on Keith's hand-covered eye. There was blood all over Keith's face and hands.
Yeah, I bet you would.
Mr. Danson's leer returned to me.
How about you? You a faggot boy? You want a little sweet tug from an old pro?
You sick son of a bitch, I cried out.
His smile dropped, but my balls, on the other hand, flew north for the winter, never to be seen again.
Well, he said.
He took a step back and looked down at Keith.
Looks like I got another date tonight, boy. Sorry. Say hello to heaven for me.
With that, Mr. Danson raised one booted foot and crashed it down like a flash of lightning, striking once, twice, three times before he dropped to his knees. He hunched over Keith's broken face. Keith wasn't moving. Mr. Danson bent down to Keith's lips. I thought he was going to kiss him. Instead, Mr. Danson spat the worm directly into Keith's bloody mouth. His head turned to me, like a wolf spotting fresh prey. I gasped and scrambled to my feet. Mr. Danson didn't bother to get up. He just came crawling on all fours. Out of pure reflex, I stepped forward like this was kickball and caught him square in the face. He sat up and cried out. Instinct screamed at me to keep on him, not to let up. Before I had time to act, Mr. Danson sprung at me. His fingers climbed into my mouth like a creepy crawly in the night and yanked in the opposite directions. My lips felt like they could split at any second. His calloused fingers tasted as bad as the bottom of our garbage can smelled. The rank image of squirming maggots and slimy leftovers shuddered through me. I screamed and pushed back against my perverted attacker with all of my strength.
Oh, a fighter, hey?
The bastard stood. I continued to drive us backwards. His fingers slid from my mouth and journeyed down my chest to my waist. We hit something on the floor and tumbled down together. I heard a loud, thick crack. Mr. Danson groaned and fell silent. I landed atop of him. I could feel the hard stick in his pants go limp beneath my ass. Then the dirt began to fall.
Oh, huh?
He moaned. The dirt, more like a damp soil, piled up on my shoulders, my thighs, and my forearms. The earthly smell was welcomed compared to the rest of the piss-soaked house.
My babies!
At first, I wasn't sure what the hell he was talking about. I figured he'd hit his head too hard and was having some kind of dizzy vision.
Then I remembered the cracked glass, the dirt, the ant farm, the worm farm. I bolted upright and swiped at the dark clumps of soil attached to me. I saw the creatures hidden within the dirt begin to squiggle just before I felt the first bite. I jerked my forearm and barked out a sharp cry. I swatted the filth and its hungry inhabitant from my skin. A flap of flesh where the thing had bitten me drooled blood and a snot-like residue. Another pinch sunk into my thigh, followed by another, and another. Behind me, Mr. Danson began yelping. I turned and saw more of the worms dig into his wrinkled flesh. One was burrowing into the side of his neck, while another turned up toward his eye. Even as one sank its strangely fanged maw into my shoulder, my gaze locked onto Mr. Danson's right eye and one of his babies with evil intentions. The splotch sound of the worm latching its fangs into his eyeball was followed by Mr. Danson's high-pitched shriek. Eye for an eye. I shot up to my feet and swatted at every inch of my body I could reach. In my mind's eye, I saw millions of the tiny beasts trying to devour me. I managed to clear the one from my shoulder and the ones that were still on my arms and thighs. I tap-danced away from the rug at my feet and the 30 to 40 gross, pale worms writhing around on the floor. Mr. Danson flailed and flopped like a giant jellyfish pulled from the sea. Keith was silent, his body still.
No, Keith.
Two of the pale worms were trying to bite through Keith's jeans. I knelt down and whacked them from his pant leg. His chest did not rise or fall.
Keith!
I took his head in my hand and slapped him hard across the face.
Keith!
I jumped at the dirty, yellowed fingernails that dug into the side of my neck. I shrugged him off.
You did this! You did this!
Mr. Danson's closed and tattered eye leaked the odd mix of blood and slime down his cheek. His clawed hands reached out for me. I stood and spotted the baseball bat by the door.
You won't! You!
I stepped over Keith and gripped the bat. Mr. Danson gave out one last ear-piercing squawk before I planted the bat down upon the center of his forehead. He dropped to the floor and lay across Keith's legs. The worms went to work on his exposed flesh. I stood still, the bat gripped in my hands and held out toward the perverted worm meal like a ninja warrior from one of the games Frankie always liked to play on his Xbox. I looked at Keith. I was pretty sure he was dead. After a moment's hesitation, I bolted out the door, the murder weapon, I was certain that my strike had killed the old man, in hand, and ran out into the cold, dark night. Halfway home, I tossed the bat into a thicket of woods near the end of my street. My lungs, my gums, my throat all burned. Still, I ran. I pumped and pumped my legs and propelled my body onward, away. I stumbled into my backyard. The sight of our back porch and my dad's trusty grill welcomed me. I dropped to my knees and flopped down on my butt. Keith Dennis may have been a jerk, but he deserved a better end than the one he got. Mr. Danson, however, earned every last nibble that he had coming from his Halloween worms. I spat down at the yellowed grass between my legs. Try as I might, I could not rid my mouth of the taste left behind from the nasty pervert's grimy fingers. I brought my knees up and reached around and locked my fingers together. I stared toward the woods down the street. Would Officer Gilchrist know I had been there too? When he found Mr. Danson and Keith Dennis, would he know that a third person had been involved? Would he find the bat? I felt the urge to seek out the weapon and toss it into the Kennebec River. My gaze dropped to the wet wound on my forearm where one of the worms had bit me. How much could one worm eat? How much of Mr. Danson could 30 or 40 of them eat? Would there be anything left? Would they finish Keith as well? My face refused to show it, but inside, I smiled when I thought about the conviction of the school bully. It may have killed him, but like a great warrior, Keith Dennis got his revenge. The end. Author's notes. As I sit down to craft these notes, it's almost Halloween, a horror writer's favorite time of year. It's a time when we can freely roll around in the blood and guts of our nastiest conjurings and receive only the slightest of dirty looks from those who dare enter our personal space. The collection of pieces you've just finished reading were written between May of 2012 and October of 2014. The genesis of this project was totally inspired by my friend Todd Kiesling and his recently released collection of excellent short stories, Ugly Little Things, and the high I'm still running on by the summer release of my debut novel, The Haunted Halls. My original plan was to put out a new Halloween story and maybe attach a couple of other short pieces with it. But as I began to dig through my files and making a list of stories I really liked, I thought, why not put out a collection?
The combination of having enough decent pieces hanging around on my laptop, Todd's inspiring works, and the hours put in of crazy, late-night, early-morning hard work from my fabulous editor, Aaron Sweet Al-Mahari, to get this done, made a Maybe I Will Try This in September of 2014 to the insane release date of October 30th, 2014 possible. Thank you, Aaron. And thank you, Todd.
Let's talk about Slush, baby. The original version of Skull of Snakes was beta read by Ronald Malfi and originally edited and accepted for publication by Jennifer Brosek for the Coins of Chaos anthology. It was my first professional sale. I am internally grateful to both Ronald and Jennifer for taking the time to read my early work and making me feel like a real writer. Jackie Boy was my first piece accepted by James Ward Kirk and remains one of my personal favorites. Plus, it made my mother say, ew, gross. It also garnered me some great looks from Ellie O'Leary at 89.9 WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, when I read it on air for the Tuesday Mayhem Society's big radio debut last spring. The curse was written after I attended one of my niece Jillian's field hockey practices. They really did practice on a field beside a cemetery. I think I actually heard the whistle of the damned as well. A not-as-pretty version was a contender in 2014's Tales from the Lake 2 competition by Crystal Lake Publishing. Candle Magic is a poem I wrote, my very first, for one of my creative writing classes. Thank you, Mrs. Riles. I'm In Here is included because of the kind words of a guy named Chris Martin. Something Lost is about my father who passed away in 1999 at the age of 52. Sweet 16 was meant to be a beautiful love story. It sort of went the other way. I just finished reading Beautiful Sorrows by Mercedes M. Yardley and really wanted to stretch my writing style in a softer direction. Wound up rather brutal. The Delicious Death of Parker Stevens features a title similar to a Bradbury story. It really came from a conversation I had with my best friend Ben about what would be really creepy. Bug children. I watched a few documentaries on flies and then watched the Jeff Goldblum movie. This was the aftermath. Henry was inspired by the personal battle I had this past winter with a horrible acne outbreak. I went with proactive over slicing it off, but obviously the thought crossed my mind. Ballad of the Best-Selling Author is my love-hate relationship with the zombie genre. There's good and bad out there. Either way, there's a lot of it. Look up Nikki Hopeman or Brian Keene. You should already be familiar with Brian, but if not, for some fun. Halloween Worm is something I started in the fall of 2013, but just lost time for. After digging it up for a Tuesday Mayhem Society meeting, I fell in love with it and knew I needed to finish it this year in time for the holidays. Peter N. Dudar pointed me toward the ending I wound up with. Thanks, Peter. Flaws is another dark piece. As soon as I decided to do this collection, I knew I needed to finish it and have it on the talk. It was hard to write due to its evil lead, but I pushed through because I think it has something to say. What is that? I guess that's up for you to decide. For better or worse, I think it has a way of clinging to you after you finish it. So that's it. Thank you to all my beta readers over the last 2 years whose eyes danced with some of these twisted words. Kristen Dearborn, Ronald Malfi, Robert S. Wilson, Todd Kiesling, Chris Martin, Celine McLeod, and Max Booth III. And thank you to all my readers. I hope you enjoy my madness. Glenn Ralph, October 2014. This has been Slush, written by Glenn Ralph, narrated by Joe Hempel. Copyright 2013-2014 by Glenn Ralph. Production copyright 2015 by Glenn Ralph.